Good evening, brothers and sisters of the Leaf. Coming to you live from the upstairs balcony of O'Brien's Irish Pub in historic downtown Temple, Texas, it's the Tuesday Night Cigar Club Podcast. Tonight, the boys take in Stephen King's Maximum Overdrive while sampling the Emilio AF1 cigar from House of Emilio, paired with some dark, mysterious pints of New Belgium Brewing Company's 1554 Black Lager beer. This lineup sounds like so much fun, I've got Maximum Overdrive in my pants right now just thinking about it. So sit back, light them up, and enjoy the show.
Tuesday. Welcome to the Tuesday Night Cigar Club Podcast. Tuesday. Tonight.
I quit.
You're out?
Yeah.
That fast. Welcome to the Tuesday Night Cigar Club Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Cade. To my right, as always, Mr. Cody Leshker. To his right, Mr. John Mincy. To his right, Mr. Jason Tuttle. We are in episode 5. I'm a little down. We were talking earlier how cool it would be to have the monster truck voiceover. We have a great voiceover guy, Mr. Keith Howe, out of Chico, California. And it's eerie how awesome it fits with what we do. But Cody had to bring up that monster truck guy, and now it's all I can think about.
Cigars! Conversation!
And,
Rehab.
They're
on their way.
We kind of
after the podcast ends.
We kind of envisioned the voice going like just hitting a little too close. Home.
Four alcoholics denying substance abuse.
Wednesday, you might want to miss it.
Thursday. Their wives pack their bags and leave. One way ticket.
Need to feel better about yourself? Watch the podcast.
Yeah.
Podcast.
So we'll stop doing that voice now. I'm sorry.
For now. I'm sure it's coming.
For now. It'll come back. I was planning on opening up things on a lively note with my AC/DC voice, but the monster truck voice kind of...
Oh, we'll get to that.
I had an idea because...
Can you do an AC/DC voice?
Oh, I'm...
We're going to have a competition.
I'm infamous. I'm glad you're wearing headphones. Your ears will be bleeding.
Yeah.
Who are you?
I just clipped everything. The board just said, fuck it.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
I can't hear you.
I'm sorry.
Then borrow those headphones.
Let's try this again. Welcome to the Tuesday Night Cigar Club Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Cade, and you know the crew here. We are pumped. We're doing the film Maximum Overdrive tonight. And... our favorite bartender in the world, Nada, has just made an appearance. And I think we're ready to rock.
We are ready to rock. Rock as hard as this soundtrack.
Rock as hard as Maximum Overdrive soundtrack. Tuttle brought up the idea of doing Maximum Overdrive. We'll get into the other fellows. I hadn't seen it probably since the 80s.
It's been a while for me as well.
With good reason. And we've got a lot to talk about. Last week, just touch on last week a little bit, we finished our epic 4-week sojourn into the world of the Drew Estate Smoking Monks. Ended on a high note with the Hefeweizen.
It was really, really good.
Really, really good. Really, really good beer, too. The Carbach Weiss Versa.
Yeah,
I still can't say it right.
Beautiful.
But we had a really good show last week. And last week's show did exactly what I've kind of envisioned the show doing, which was capture what we do on Tuesday nights when the mics aren't on, is we talk at something and around something so much that I end up waking up Wednesday and realizing something new about it. Something I thought I knew everything about.
You're going to say, I end up waking up Wednesday outside after those first few moments where I wonder why.
Well, a lot of times it is outside, or in my truck, or in a dumpster, or at the YMCA, but enough about that. It did it. We talked around Escape from New York and Escape from L.A., especially Escape from L.A. so much that it really changed the way I kind of looked at it. And that's what we do on Tuesdays. We really, multiple opinions, multiple voices going at something. And I love those nights where we kind of smoke and drink our way into something interesting, which wouldn't happen without the smoking or the drinking. So that's what the TNC is all about. So we finished the Smoking Monk series. Also last week, our biggest highlight was, or called a highlight, We got to envision Tuttle's face on Adrian Barbeau's body.
Oh,
Tuttle Barbeau, we call her.
If you haven't checked out the website, check it out, because I'm looking
good. If you
want
to see it, it's on TuesdayNightCigarClub.com, the episode 4 page. And it's disturbing, boys.
I have already copyrighted the term disturbages, combination of disturbing images for a company I'm going to start. So don't anybody out there take that idea away.
Okay.
For a revenue stream.
It was disturbing, and Tuttle's reasoning behind the creation of Tuttle Barbeau was disturbing.
Disturbing, arousing.
Mincy was brought in an interesting
point.
You noticed
right after that episode, I got a haircut. I can't be looking
at it. I got a haircut, just to be safe. But it was a really good show, and I should add that we are adding more and more clips on YouTube, on our YouTube channel. I think we've got 18 up from episode 4. Just 2-3 minute highlights to get you into what we're doing, and check out our YouTube channel. I'm convinced if you give a couple clips a whirl, you'll kick it over to iTunes and check out the whole show. So please do. But tonight, no more monks. Sorry to see him go, but happy to do something else. We'll get to the cigar in a minute. First, I wanted to check in with Mincy. Mincy's homework corner. Weather has been really shitty lately. Have you any cigars since the last time you saw us? Or
yes, not? But nothing new. Okay. It had been a while, much like the movie. I did get an opportunity. The weather had been pretty lousy, but I did get an opportunity to go to Up and Smoke and get a Davidoff. It had been a while since I had one.
Is this your usual, your white label, or was this a...
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And wasn't very big. They kind of have multiple sizes, not the normal ones, you know, other than Robusto, Corona, Churchill. They kind of have several other smaller ones. They're not much bigger than, like, a Cigarillo. And the one I had, they're not inexpensive, any of them, but it was really not much bigger than a Fuente. Very smooth. I didn't have it while I was drinking anything.
Your Fuente short story, you had the very small four and a half inches.
Yeah, and...
which I know that's what you're used to.
But nobody else who knows me is, so... For me, that's a personal record. At one point, I had had one the last time, I think, with a Crown and 7-Up, and very smooth. But this goes good just with anything, so... Because I've had Davidoff before, it wasn't really too much in the way of homework. But definitely, if you... I kind of put Davidoff's in that area of if you want something good, you're going to have to pay for it. It's definitely an enjoyable cigar, pretty smooth. But now that the weather's gotten much better, hopefully I'll be able to try several more before next time.
Well, good. We'll check back in with you. I'm going to get right into the cigar tonight. We're smoking the Emilio AF1. It is from the House of Emilio umbrella of cigars. It's blended by A.J. Fernandez. Who's pretty much well-known. He's a very well-known blender, but he blends the Manowar cigars, the Diesel line, I know Tuttle and I have sampled a lot of the Diesels. They really good smokes, and the San Lotano line. But he does a lot of work for different things, and he blended AF1, obviously, for A.J. Fernandez, one for House of Emilio. This is our first submitted cigar for review, so it's kind of a milestone for us as far as receiving cigars in the mailbox for us knuckleheads to talk around and light them up.
AJ, I'm going to rip into this.
I should give a little shout out to a close confidant of the, and he really is a confidant of the Tuesday Night Cigar Club, Rev Java. Rev. Really, he's a cigar buddy of ours from up north, the state of New York. He really dug the idea of our podcast and what we're doing, and he put us in touch with Gary Griffith, who runs House of Emilio. He's a big retail guy, owns 30-plus cigar shops in Delaware, Delaware Cigars. Wanted to get into developing his own lines, and Gary was the one who actually... sent us some samples, and really excited to do something new on the show. We talked last week a lot about the Jose Blanco seminar we went to, and one of the wrappers that really kind of sparked Tuttle's interest was the Mexican San Andreas wrapper. And we're in luck tonight because this is a well-fermented San Andreas wrapper. It should be a medium to full-bodied smoke. Usually it's all Nicaraguan filler. And we should be looking at, I would think, based on, you know, the wrapper and what I've read, you know, some sweetness and some spiciness and all that good fun stuff.
Yeah,
so,
already hitting with the spice right off the light.
Yeah, immediately, we all just lit up, immediately got some spice right off the...
I like it.
Right off the light.
Yeah, well, it wasn't quite as spicy like as the Nicaruscas that were running, but it was not that far off. It was just kind of a nice little pop.
It settled down very quickly, but I got an initial really big blast. So, you know, just another real quick shout out. We've been smoking our own stash with the monks, so to speak. This is our first submitted smoke. If you're enjoying the podcast and the website, we do a full write up on every beer, every cigar, every film. If you want us to feature your stuff, please drop us a line on the Twitter podcast. We have an email on the website. We'd love to, you know, give your cigars a showcase. And you know, you got four very different palettes to give four very.
Not saying we might not like
it. If we don't like it, we don't like it. But you know, we're going to talk it through, and you're going to get four different opinions. So it's going to be a good thing. And as of now, we are ranked number one on iTunes, the number one ranked podcast for film, cigars, and beer reviews. So, you know, that's nothing to shake your head at. It's a good feather in our caps. So, I think we're the only ones. I got to be honest, but we're making strides. I mean, we're five episodes in and things are going really well.
Number two is a podcast with some guy who makes Iceman malt liquor, and
so
we beat him out.
Hey, and that guy hustles. I give much respect to him. He's number two, but he does hustle.
Originally, I would just real quick. We were to review tonight. This is a good and not a bad thing. But we were originally going to review the Texian Battle Line Brown Ale tonight, and we're very pumped up about it. And apparently, so were a lot of people at O'Brien's Irish Pub in downtown Temple, Texas, because as the waitress went to fill our pint glasses, the keg floated, and no more Texian Battle Line Brown Ale for us. So we had to readjust. We had to go down to the taps, strategically look at what was available. We got 41 taps down here at O'Brien's. Can't stress enough. We talked about going TJ's in McGregor, TJ's Cigar Lounge. If you are anywhere in the state of Texas traveling, you know, around Austin, around Waco, make the trip to O'Brien's. 41 taps on the wall. And I'm going to turn it over to Cody to let him fill you in on what we chose to replace the Texian, and then we'll get right into the movie.
As you said, we had Texian, not all the, you know, best laid plans and all that. So switching over, we with the New Belgium 1554 Enlightened Black Ale.
Enlightened?
Enlightened.
Much like myself.
Well, we'll find out.
Shut up, Lindsay.
New Belgium started in 91. It's one of the older craft breweries.
Like here in Nevada. They're one of the early guys.
Yes. Yeah. In 91, they are located in Fort Collins, Colorado. Most people might know them from their Fat Tire Amber Ale. That's their flagship beer. Everybody knows the little red bicycle. That is also a wonderful beer. But the 1554, it's black lager. It's roughly right around 5.5% alcohol, and it's about... The black, it comes from a recipe that one of their head brewmasters found himself in Belgium and helped to recreate it.
How does one become a head brewmaster?
By brewing a lot of beer. Mastering the brewing of beer.
I'm probably too old for that.
Oh, there's work involved then.
It's a young man's game. Brewmastering's a young man's game.
Yeah. You don't see a lot of old guys in it.
Yeah. You gotta have energy.
Stamina.
Okay, never mind. Wrong career choice for me.
Yeah, no. You're never gonna be a brewmaster.
No.
I'm never gonna be a brewmaster. Young Paul.
Could be
a brewmaster.
Young Steven.
He's working on it.
What's up, Steven?
These are not MIA members of the TNCC. They don't join us on the podcast. So he's really going to go out there with something new with this one.
They were. They were looking for, you know, a lot of places had have, and breweries have been looking for, you know, not just a not just strong alcohol, or, you know, like with the IPA where you get a lot more hops, you get a lot more bitterness. They're looking for a strong flavor, and that's what they were trying to do with the black ale.
When we were looking at the taps downstairs, you told me this lied somewhere between a porter and a brown ale, maybe?
It's a little bit darker than I mean, it can depend. They used, for this one,
porter and a brown
they had used a lager yeast, but then they had accompanied that with much darker malts, chocolate, black,
okay,
some pale malts, but it definitely does give it it's very smooth. It's about 21 IBUs.
So no low bitterness.
Low bitterness.
I'll say this, when we were going over beers to possibly jump in on this pairing, Cody's description of it, you know, fitting in with the dark Maduro wrapper that we're doing tonight, that made sense to me. And I'll just be honest with you, the New Belgium Brewing Company, they kind of won out of, you know, the three or four beers we're looking at. Mincy can remember this. Back on graduation day, my first film, out of college, we approached a lot of beer companies because there was a lot of beer drinking in our film, and we were looking for sponsorship. And one of the few to respond, and boy did they respond, was New Belgium Brewery.
We were looking for sponsorship and somebody to sustain our alcoholism.
And they did
and
both.
And they did both wondrously.
We had more cases of Fat Tire. What was the other beer? Blue? What's their other one?
We had Negra Modelo on that.
No, that
as
was
well.
the other sponsor. What was their other? It was Fat Tire, and I thought they had a blue something. Or anyway, mainly it was Fat Tire. Cases and cases of Fat Tire delivered. They even gave us one of those Fat Tire bicycles, which we learned because the bar owner, who was one of our investors, when he found out we got that, his eyes lit up. He's like, nobody gets the Fat Tire bike. It was an old, like, Pee Wee Herman, huge red bicycle, vintage bicycle. So, you know, we gave it to Randy, and he put it up in his bar. And so they couldn't have been better, you know, when I was kind of starting out as a filmmaker. They really came through. So immediately, you know, let's see how this pairing works. And, you know, I'm excited. First couple sips, guys, how you...
Finally, a dark beer that's not tasting like coffee.
I'm getting chocolate, not coffee.
I like the match of it with a cigar, actually. I don't know why.
Okay.
There's something about it. It's a little bit darker than.
I'm getting a dark chocolate off the beer immediately, which I really like. The last porter we had, or the Spinny Mule, was really coffee heavy. And
a lot of people, when they go into the stouts and the porters and they go dark, it's like, oh, we need to make it coffee.
I love coffee, but I'm really digging I'm not picking up any coffee in this, which is nice. And yeah, it is going well, the cigar. You guys, just off the first light, Cody, we always go to you when we go, you know, darker cigar because you prefer the lighter stuff. But
this is, before I lit up, I mean, I could definitely tell that this had a earthy, leathery aroma going in, so I mean that's definitely out of my wheelhouse. I don't normally go with something strong. I'm more to the medium to mild, but even this one is, after lighting it and getting into the first few puffs, it's normally a lot of them. I'll say this, I can tell when it's strong. It's my lips are tingling. And that usually comes from the darker.
It's interesting that you mention that, because ever since I put that I had an earthy, leathery aroma on my dating profile, I have not had a single email.
Hey, I mean,
that was you. You're Sally 69 from Grapevine.
I will say this, Mincy. I don't think your microphone's working. I can't hear anything you're saying. I will say this with the AF1. The burn line on this sucker is completely, I mean, from a construction standpoint, it's a beautiful cigar. The burn line is completely straight. But this is a perfect example of a dark wrapped cigar, a Maduro cigar, that is not full bodied. This is a medium bodied cigar. No way, and I think that's what you were getting at, it's not blowing us away with its nicotine and its power at all.
Yeah.
This is a really, so far, the initial spice is mellowed out.
Smoke.
And look at the smoke. It's got Liga-esque smoke.
Yeah.
When the smoke rolls off the foot of the cigar, travels up the body of the cigar, and meets the smoke coming out of the head, I mean, that's just a beautiful thing.
Love it.
So, construction-wise right now, taste, I'm... Yeah, off initial light, I think we're all thumbs up.
I agree.
So now that we've introduced this so far so good cigar and our surprise beer of the night, we are going to get into Maximum Overdrive, 1986.
Yes.
Boy, what a good time period. 86.
Absolutely.
Great time period for horror movies. Great
it's
time.
A great time to be alive.
Great time for action movies. Great time for. Those people downstairs. A lot of fans of 1986 right here. I'm getting lots of notes of merriment and just loving
mirthfulness.
Mirthfulness.
That's right. The crowd they're is mirthy. Giving
the laughter mirthy. Of the damned.
They're very mirthy down there. And well, they're at O'Brien's. It's what we do. We do mirth, and we do it well.
That's right.
So, Maximum Overdrive was the first film written based on a short story, Trucks, by Stephen King. Stephen King actually adapted it into a screenplay. And for the first time, courtesy of producer Dino De Laurentiis, was given an opportunity to direct his own screenplay.
Yeah.
And this was... I will shift over to Tuttle here for a second. This was selected. Tuttle asked us to do this film, I believe without having watched it since 1986. And next thing I know, here we are in the meat grinder.
All right, so basically we got
what happened to Tuttle? Used to be somebody we could trust.
Basically we got the story of a mysterious comet comes through next to Earth.
Ray M is the comet.
Raya M?
R-H-E-A. I believe that's Ray. Minty? Rhea?
Could be Rhea or Ray. I don't know.
I'm going to go with Ray. You don't have diarrhea.
Diarrhea. Mm. So Rhea M?
Yeah. So big green comic.
I had diarrhea after watching this film.
Easy. It was a...
It wasn't that good.
It was an honest try, effort. Sorry, Stephen. It's machines come alive, start cleaning out, sweeping humanity. At first, I always thought that it was anything electrical... / mechanical, but then I'm kind of wondering why water hoses are turning on.
Or mechanical things that could have turned on didn't.
Yeah.
There's really no rhyme or reason to the things that turned against mankind. Some cars did, some cars didn't.
I just remember there's two things I really loved about it. I've always liked the dystopian future, the sci-fi-ness kind of post-apocalypse type deals. So this was kind of in that wheelhouse. But then again, it was the soundtrack. I'm a huge AC/DC fan.
So we watch this movie because you love AC/DC.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah.
Who made you?
Oh, God.
Who made you?
I will go bold enough to say it's definitely in the top 10 soundtracks of all time. Mine encroach on the top 5, except for all of the John Williams scores and the Ennio, the spaghetti western dude.
Ennio Morricone.
That dude.
Well, we start with a comet. We're in the tail end of a comet for 8 days. The film opens in one of my favorite scenes where this schlub tourist is going to an ATM machine in the big city. It's played by Stephen King, and the scrolling bank sign.
Is he kind of like a? Stan Lee always got to have a cameo in the.
He has enough. Yeah, he used to. I don't know if he does.
He
so
did
much
a lot
anymore.
back in the old days.
But the scrolling digital sign across the bank that gives you the temperature just starts scrolling. Fuck you. As he's walking up to it.
When did the aliens get so?
And
so
then
nice
he starts.
Slang,
he puts in his pen and the screen just starts calling him an asshole. And you know, King's like, "Hey, honey, get over here." This goddamn machine's calling me an asshole. So immediately I'm like, all right, this movie's going to rock. Maybe I remembered wrong. This movie's going to be great. Because that little scene, I'm like, all right, we're good. And then AC/DC kicks in, and we have the dam scene. The opening credits play over the scene of a bridge where the computers take over, and they start raising this dam. And dudes are just
trucks, cars, watermelon trucks.
Supposedly, there's a... You can't see who's in it, but Stephen King was a huge fan of AC/DC. They're his favorite band.
Yeah,
the speedboat going under the drawbridge is supposed to have... Yeah, so that's when I picture Brian Johnson. The speedboat is going up!
No, I actually heard, if you listen, on the Laserdisc, there's an audio track, like third audio, you click it, you hear, look at the bridge! Oh my God!
You see Angus Young in his little shorts jumping around?
I thought they were swim trunk, but he actually had, he wears
no,
those,
a normal outfit.
He wears those when he's swimming.
What's happening with the drawbridge?
That's our first inclination that things are going bad fast. And my favorite scene from that thing, which comes into play later, is when all these cars are sliding down the dam as it raises. People are, you know, running for their lives. They're horrible deaths. Really good, gruesome car crashes.
Yeah, that was
like
a good scene.
Some good carnage.
Yeah.
But there's one scene where the car flips and it's the couple in their tennis gear.
Oh.
And the chick, the wife, is in her little tennis trunks. And the guy gets out and he immediately slips on watermelons. But he's got these little, you know, little tennis shorts on, and falls. His wife's
good
like,
1980s.
His wife's like, "Help me!" And dude, he gives her this. I don't know if you guys caught it. He gives her this little glance. He's like, "Fuck that!" And he starts running, but then he slips on the watermelons and he's toast. So he's like, you know, I saw that as King humor. Like King is so. Always been so good with humor, like he just wanted to set up this kind of farcical, but bloody as hell. And I thought,
especially for the time,
I thought it was a really good mix of bloody, so you know it's real, but some kind of slapstick stuff. And I'm like, even at that point, I'm like, all right, this has the makings of King on it. And the AC/DC soundtrack, you know what? That Who Made Who. You
can never go wrong with a 4/4 beat, man.
It's a huge plus. I mean, it's the only thing Stephen King ever directed. He'd written things for the screen. He'd acted before. He had a part in one of the Creepshow shorts.
Meteor shit.
Right, so he was like the lead in one of the shorts, but he had never actually directed anything. And interestingly enough, I think what happened is he's always said before that he didn't give a crap. It was just, if someone's going to adapt a book he wrote, he's getting a check, and he just leaves it at that. But he really didn't like The Shining.
Yeah.
The initial one with Jack Nicholson, which is hard to
imagine.
Hated
it. He still talks about it.
And I think this was a case where he was just... He had some kind of... He said a couple of different things about directing, which one was that I didn't get to direct this because I went to film school or have any experience. I directed it because I was Stephen King, and if you're famous enough, they'll let you hang yourself in Times Square and have live TV footage.
Sure.
So... He said before that during the shooting of the film that he was coked out of his brain. And
really?
Yes, yeah. And that fits with the timeline. I'm a huge, huge fan of Stephen King. And up until he was about 40 years old, and I think this was shot in the summer of 85, so he was in his late 30s, he was an alcoholic and turned to cocaine at the end of it. So that probably explains a few things. I think there's a lot. I love the opening. I love the drawbridge scene. Yeah. I absolutely love the next scene where that vending machine goes apeshit and starts firing those fastball Coke cans.
We'll get to that in
brains the
like,
coach.
There was a lot of good set pieces early on in the film that gave me hope. And you're right. And if you watch the, you know, first thing I do is I watch the trailer. If you watch the trailer for this, it's Stephen King talking to the audience.
I remember that too.
And he's like, I'm Stephen King. I'm the master of horror. I'm tired of people fucking up my movies. I'm going to do it right. And I'm going to scare the shit out of you. Literally, it's the trailer is him and it's mixed in.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember this. I was watching it, and I think I had heard this somewhere else over the years. I can't remember where. It was probably Brian Collins, the Badass Digest, the Horror Movie a Day guy. I think he pointed out once. They set that trailer to Halloween 3, the Carpenter's music. And it works perfectly for the trailer. But I was like, holy shit, that's Carpenter. But it's Stephen King telling how he's going to do it right. Now, this is after The Shining, after Carrie.
Yeah.
After Christine.
After a lot of people
Children
have done it
Corn.
Really, really well. This is him set, which makes
was
sense.
After Children of the Corn?
Yeah, that came out in 84.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, who can question the creative mind when you're we can only you can only imagine.
Is that all right there?
You can only imagine if you're a novelist and you've seen so many of your things taken away from you with million-dollar checks involved.
Yeah.
But to watch them on the big screen, I can only imagine you're never going to be 100% satisfied because they're altering your words, they're altering your story. So this is going to be, I guess, his attempt at, you know what, I'm doing this my way.
It's going to be true.
I do think there's something to be said for the place he was at in his life, though, with substance abuse, where it was kind of a megalomaniacal aspect of, well, I should direct this film. Everyone's telling me, you've written screenplays, you've acted, why not direct it?
Yeah.
He has since said that, you know, people have asked him, why haven't you directed again? And he said, watch Maximum Overdrive, that's your answer. but he's also said that he wished he had done it again sober.
Yeah. Well, I would have liked to see him tackle a different story. I don't know if this is the story for him to expand on. I mean, if you read the short film, before getting into the film, I mean, the short film is maybe 10 pages in the Night Shift short story collection.
Yeah.
And it basically encompasses the very tail end of the story, where the vehicles have already taken over. It's just vehicles. It's no other electronics. These guys are, the people in the diner are already downtrodden and desolate. And on their wits' end. And it basically, and this ties into your love of post-apocalyptic stuff, they kind of, as the hero goes and realizes that these machines want them to feed them gas, and we have to make a move here. Are we going to be slaves and change an oil filter and gas every time these things honk their horns? Or, you know, what's the other option? The hero of the thing, which is just a traveler, it's not the Emilio Estevez guy, it's just a character. He equates it to, what's our other option? If we run and make it to that ditch outside the diner, outside the trucks, what are we going to do, go live in the caves, the only place, you know, that aren't paved for these guys to get us? And start drawing in caves again, pictures of men and women and trucks and reduced to this primitive state, because eventually Detroit is an automated car thing. They're going to get slaves to make more cars. They're going to get trucks to pave roads and dump road material where there's not roads. They'll find us. It's a Terminator type thing. Yeah. These things are going to become where they can self-reproduce. And it was left with this very bleak, no hope ending, you know, with these guys pumping this gas. And, you know, that's not, when we get into this film, that's not the approach he took with this film. But it was a very short story, and I don't know, it was a very effective short story.
Don't the trucks in the story, because I started to read some of it, I didn't get through it. I read it a couple times before, though. Don't they actually start, in the short story, don't they start, like, bashing the truck stop? A couple of them are, like, bashing in.
Unlike in the film, they're not. These guys aren't really given a choice to be slaves or whatever. It's either die or start pumping gas and fast. But we're gonna. But I just thought, out of all of, because Mincy and I know have read all the King short stories. I grew up with a copy of Skeleton Crew and Night Shift falling to pieces because I would read it every night. And there's so many short stories in there that I went to dozens of times. Whether it be Gray Matter, whether it be The Lawnmower Man, whether it be The Mist.
Well, the initial Children of the Corn story is very different from the way the movie
was. The original Children of the Corn. This one was just, it was curious to me why he picked this one. But when you factor in substance abuse, and you know what? If I'm coked up and drinking, and I want to see some fucking trucks blow up, and just some crazy shit on someone else's dime, I probably would pick this one.
I think he definitely can tell a story.
Oh, yeah.
That's obviously an understatement. I think that, and somebody had said this about him too, that he should have given another chance because visually, I think he's able to articulate what he wants. There's a lot of great scenes in it. If there's one area, I knew from that time period in his life, because I'd read about him, that was when things were really getting to their low as far as his, you know, a case of beer a day, substance and then cocaine, abuse. And then, you know, I think that at one point, like, his wife noticed that bottles of mouthwash were showing up empty at an irregular pace, and it got really bad. To his credit, he cleaned up. He's been sober for over 25 years. But so I think visually he knew what he wanted. If there's one thing where you look at it and say, okay, when you say you don't know what you're doing, I understand, it's probably in being able to direct actors.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely. Well, and that's a very perfect moment to jump into the film itself, because right after the great dam scene and the action scene, which you said are captured really, really...
It really hooks you in from the beginning.
It hooks you in at that point. There's nothing lacking from a cinematography standpoint.
Yeah.
The execution of those scenes are great. The tennis short guy leaving his wife. I don't know why, I just love that. But we soon find ourselves at the Dixie Boy Diner truck stop, where all the rest of the action will take place. Sans the little blonde-haired boy who wanders around aimlessly for an hour and kind of gets us nowhere. But once we're at the Dixie Boy, the first... very quickly, we're still, you know, things are just now starting to happen on Earth with these, or at least in North Carolina, with these trucks and gadgets. This is where I don't know, you know, what, because, you know, I read Night Shift and the writing is so good and it's so descriptive, but so. And then we get to the first death immediately once we get to the Dixie. The guy, trucker pulls in with the Happy Toys Green Goblin semi, the most iconic thing from this film. And gas attendant is pumping gas, and it stops. And he immediately turns it towards him, sticks his finger in the gas nozzle, and then sticks his eye in it. And guess what happens? Pure petroleum straight in his face. And that's the first time we also hear the...
Do you recognize the actor?
No, I did not.
Okay. Those are probably two of the... And I'm not saying that they do anything to make you anything special happen. Those are two of the professional actors that probably are able to show up on a picture, realize they're not getting anything from the director and work with it. One is the truck driver, the black guy Frankie Faison, who's been in a ton of shit. The guy that gives himself the petroleum in the face, J.C. Quinn, also in a ton of shit, but you'll remember him most as Craig Sheffer's dad in The Program. His drunken father.
The drunken father.
Joe Kane's father in The Program.
Yeah.
He also was Michael Rooker's crew chief in Days of Thunder.
Oh, I remember from Program.
But he's been a ton of stuff. Yeah. But him and Frankie Faison are two people. They probably, like, I'm not saying anyone knows who they are other than complete movie nerds, but they can probably show up and go, all right, we're not getting anything. We can do something.
Well, the execution... Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, there was another guy in there, Leo something.
Leon Rippey.
Yeah, I recognized him as well.
He's been in a ton of crap.
Yeah, he's been like a character actor type.
He had a very small role.
Yeah, it was like Dan. He was like one of the truckers there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was just kind of background, too.
Oh, okay. Well, this guy, you know, because one of the and I thought this, the execution of the scene, you saw it coming a mile away.
Oh, yeah.
The gas, the look. Or the finger, then the look. Like, you saw that. You saw what was coming a mile away. And one of the biggest problems, and that's my first red flag with this movie. I was like, okay, that shouldn't have happened.
No.
One of the biggest things that King criticizes Kubrick for The Shining, was he didn't know how to execute scares. And he said, you know what? The Shining is like a big, gorgeous... beautiful car with no engine in it, because he didn't know how to do a horror movie. And his example was when Shelley Duvall makes her way down to the typewriter and is looking. Finally, she goes down there to see what this guy's been writing, Jack. And he comes, she's all those pages of all work and no play make Jack a dull boy. King's thing was, it's a horror movie. Two things the audience is expecting. One, as she's looking through those pages, she turns around and there he is. And you're scared. Or you're hoping that she puts it back and gets away. Those are your two options in a horror movie. Kubrick didn't do that. He shows Jack Torrance walking around the wall.
In a beautiful
pan shot behind that wall. And approaching her.
Yeah.
Not one of the two options that a horror audience is used to.
Yeah.
And he's like, this guy doesn't know how to make horror movies. Now I flash to this gas nozzle. With this dude looking down the gas nozzle with his eye in there, and like, all right, if this is where we're going, if you think this is what horror audiences are, you know, expecting, thank you, then we're in for a very bumpy ride here, because there's no suspense, there's no, I know what's about to happen, and you've
borders on horror and black comedy, though, throughout.
So it shoots the guy in the face. Mistake number one for this poor bastard. Oh, he makes another horrible mistake later.
what I just couldn't figure out is I'm like, so you're telling me that a guy who's a...
It's his job.
It's his job.
His job is to pump gas.
Should I like,
isn't your, that number one on the list of rules?
I figured at least they would at least pan the camera over to the thing. Do not put point in face.
Day one on the job, don't ever turn the gas nozzle into your face and look down it for some blockage.
So he gets blasted. So we're like, all right. And that's the first time we hear that music.
Why is 12 gauge not working? Yeah, I better stare down the barrel.
That's the first time we hear, like, Tuttle's motioning, the psycho music. The every time somebody gets killed, there's this horrible gratiating. Was that AC/DC? Did they do that?
No. Well, I don't know if they did.
I
the
thought
psycho
they did the whole thing,
but they did the, they did an undertrack to it, to where it's like.
No, they do all the bass. Some really.
Stephen King is on the cocaine. He won't give none to me.
They do really cool undertone kind of things, and like a lot of stuff they did. Did you notice was instrumentals of their song?
Yeah.
Like for those about to rock, we salute you. They would just do the bass of it.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of cool. No disrespect there. And then we get... so he gets killed. You know, he's toast. And then the waitress... did she come later?
She came later.
I'm talking about... go inside the diner, and an electric butcher knife, she's making eggs. All of a sudden, an electric butcher knife comes alive and slices her main artery, blood everywhere... And then it starts sawing her foot off, and they just bandage her up. She's fine. But, so, it's still, things are happening rapidly, and I'm digging it. Because things are like, there's no down on this movie. It's like, go, 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 and I'm really digging it. And then we get to the baseball game. We cut away from the diner, and we go to the baseball game.
You aren't seeing that in a 21st century movie. No. Little league ball players getting brained by soda cans and get run over by bulldozers.
This scene lets you know immediately that kids, dogs, everybody's fair game.
Everybody's fair
and
game.
And that's the sure sign that the dude directing is coked out of his mind.
The one kid puts on the catcher's mask and ducks down and gets in position so they bounce off.
I love this scene.
Dude, that was great.
So these guys.
Oh, shit. I better get down and punch Rodriguez's position.
This team finishes their little league match and the coach is going to buy them some sodas. And he goes over there and he puts his money in. And of course, like the gas pump, it doesn't work. So he puts his face right in the hole and he just gets...
It shoots out like a Randy Johnson fastball.
Pummeled with sodas. He's got an indent on his forehead at this perfect soda.
Well, you know, at first it's just, you know, it's...
And the kids are great. They're total Stephen King kids. They're like, what the shit? And then they get killed.
Say it was nice that when they cut back to the coach... After he's already been laid out, he's doing the Twitch thing. I was like, that's kind of cool. I like that.
And our hero kid, the one who puts the catcher's mitt on and survives the barrage of kids, he tries to save the coach.
Yeah.
And I was like, they're establishing him as... Because Stephen King is notorious for making young kids heroes in his stories. So I'm like, all right, this kid's being built up to something. He's gonna be a hero. Unlike Emilio Estevez, who the girl will tell you he's a hero, Stephen King's letting us see it in this instance.
Love like a hero.
Well, we'll get to that. So the kid gets on his bike and he's out of there. But not before, what is it, a street sweeper? Is that what that, the thing with a huge wheel on the front?
Steamroller.
The steamroller breaks through the baseball field and runs over one of his buddies. It's just blood and guts all over the roller. It's awesome.
Good.
And this kid just hightails it. And at this point, I'm like, this movie rocks. Everybody's fair game. And, you know, here we go. And then we're introduced. It's fallen a good thing. We met the diner folks.
Yeah.
We met the baseball kid. And now we're meeting the newlyweds, played by, Yeardley Smith of
Lisa Simpson.
Lisa Simpson fame. And I believe Andrew McCarthy's long-lost brother.
No.
Dude, tell me you didn't see McCarthy in that day.
You see McCarthy in every...
I did not.
Please, no impersonations!
What's that supposed to mean, Yax?
I don't know
why. Not everybody's like you. We don't all harbor the same prejudices. Tuttle? Am I right?
No, you're not right. Why can't you look at the other person in the eyes?
I'm looking at you, Tuttle.
He's looking at his nose, yeah!
Mincy, I'm looking at you now, right?
It was horrible, dude.
I'm just going to do the rest of this podcast as Brian
Johnson. Sorry, that dude looked just like Andrew McCarthy with blonde hair.
No.
Cigars burning nice!
You see what you want to see. I'll put it like
all
that.
All right,
well...
I agree, yeah.
This young, handsome devil who looks like Andrew McCarthy, he and his newlywed wife, Yearly Smith, get attacked by trucks on the road, and they have no recourse but to, you know, escape to the diner. So now we've got them in the diner, and there we meet, you know, what is it, Mr. Hendershot?
Mr. Hendershot. You've actually met him before. He was
the Pat Hingle. He's the owner of the truck stop.
Yeah.
Played by...
Pat Hingle.
First thing I recognize him as is Commissioner Gordon from Tim Burton's Batman movies.
Long-time actor, though.
He was the
hanging judge.
You know what my wife, Jenny, said... He was from Porky's, but I didn't recognize him.
No, he was not.
I thought he was.
That's what she said. Yeah, it's funny because I looked him up and he wasn't on Porky's. Yeah. But she thought the same thing.
He has played numerous... He's played very... That character he played, a person of authority, usually a law person, but he's always had the same...
He was the judge in Hang 'Em High with Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, I think that was one of his big...
I'm thinking that what happened with him is he's another professional actor who probably showed up and Stephen King, the limit of the direction was... You're going to call everybody Bubba and speak in this accent.
I couldn't understand half the stuff he said.
You're going to be the stereotypical Southerner.
He probably read two lines of Stephen King and he probably said, oh yeah, that's good. Just do that for the rest of the movie and that's all. That's what you got.
I couldn't understand anything Pat Hingle said in this movie. I mean, it was a lot of Cajun jibber-jabber.
It switched accents. It went from like New Jersey to Boston
Cajun. It was all over the place. But we get back to the diner. We see him. He has this guy, Joey or Bubba. You know, the fat gas guy lighting his cigars for him, which I'm...
Damn it, Joey!
I'm going to kind of solicit somebody to do that. I like the idea of somebody lighting my cigars for me.
Oh, I guess somebody probably...
He did have the classic, you know, machine-rolled...
No, he always had a machine-rolled cigar in his hand. But that Joey guy was always lighting it for him with that
Hey, you
Zippo.
Pay me enough, dude. I'll put on 100 pounds and walk around lighting your stogies for you.
How much?
Enough to quit my job.
Yeah.
We do other stuff?
What do you mean by other stuff?
Well, that'll be on Tuesday night.
All of a sudden, light your cigar has a lot of meanings.
You check out our YouTube
page. Why do I keep doing quote fingers? Why does it keep using this quote finger? Sorry.
Oh, man.
For those about to love a cigar, we salute you.
Okay, out of our two listeners, we just lost one. I'm sorry, Mom.
All right, because I'm into me.
Which one of us is worse with the Brian Johnson? Are we equally bad?
Oh man, I kind of put you a little bit ahead of Kate. Sorry, dude.
Yeah. But mine's more accurate.
But that's like going arsenic or strychnine.
Yours is indeed more ear splitting. Well, you know, I'm sitting next to you.
It's funny. I used to do karaoke when I lived in Canada.
I guess I'm the strychnine.
I'm going to give my Canadian friend Paul Austin, who took me under his wing, a shout out. I didn't realize at the time they were gay karaoke bars, but I was doing the Doors backdoor man for weeks, and I was just getting...
I wondered why there were no women in the audience, ever.
Showered with praise. And I was like, you
Phone
know
numbers.
What, Paul, I'm changing up tonight. I'm going to go AC/DC. And I worked really hard on it, and I haven't done it since. Corey Tuttle, I shouldn't do it again.
That's how drunk Cade was in the year 2000. He had no idea he was in a gay bar for a month.
I didn't know I was in Canada.
Just thought they were being very polite.
Spent 2 years up there one weekend. So we're finally getting everyone to congregate into this diner. Another couple, a preacher, a traveling preacher is traveling with a female hitchhiker.
Which was the one guy that I happened to recognize, Murnie.
Did you recognize him as from Secret of My Success?
No.
No.
Last Dragon. He played the bad guy. Not Show Enough, but
I was
about
to say, it didn't look like Show Enough.
No, he wasn't Carrie. He was the bad guy that backed Show Enough. That got him to beat up
the evil
Bruce Leroy.
White guy.
Yes.
Alright.
Cody's a big Dragon movie guy. I recognized him as he ran the mail room in Secret of My Success. He was always the one looking at Michael.
Props to both of y'all. I didn't. See,
I knew him immediately.
Didn't recognize him at all.
He's the guy who's always busting Michael J. Fox's chops about being late. You know, down to the mailroom.
Yeah.
So he's a traveling preacher, and he picks up this hitchhiker, and he's trying to feel her upper leg the whole time, and finally, she just grabs the wheel and swerves them into the diner.
Yeah.
Where they take up shop with everybody else. Now, that's our first interaction with Estevez. Emilio Estevez plays this on probation, small-time criminal.
Yeah.
He was forced into it. He's a good guy. He's forced into it because he needed gas money. But he meets this girl. Oh.
Talk about cringeworthy.
And it's Stephen King writing this stuff, and it's cringeworthy.
Yeah, but see, that's where I'm saying that if a guy that's been acting for 20 years shows up, he can look at it and go, I'm not getting any help. The 23-year-old Estevez,
yeah, he needed
a little help. I just say, he looked stoned.
He looked, his eyes were watery. But the first scene where she's, out of nowhere, she comes up to him, and she's like, you know what, you're cute.
Everything between the two of them was
like,
awful.
And he's like, so am I? And it's just so awkward and so unbelievable. It's horrible.
Yeah.
Like, how would the man behind the monitor watching this, as the director, be like, cut.
Oh, I love that chemistry. That chemistry
is
awesome.
You guys nailed this. People are going to root for you. Yeah. No, they're not. It's horrible.
Well, that's what I mean. He's not a film director. He has no idea. That's a situation where those are people that don't have any chops, and they needed some help.
You're right. You're exactly right. That's where I saw it when I was watching it through it. I was like, I had to keep coming back to that. This guy could not do actors. He could not direct actors.
It was awful. It was cringeworthy.
Yeah.
So now we've established
every scene between the two.
Everyone who's going to be at the diner now, and there's some other random truckers and whatnot there. The trucks begin circling. The automated trucks with no drivers begin circling the truck stop. Before I get into gas station attendants number two, big mistake, how's the beer and cigars working for you guys? I'm really loving the cigar.
I am too.
I am beginning to be able to taste the strength of it for myself.
Yeah. Yeah, so about midway through,
much stronger.
Stronger. You're about 2 inches.
This
is we're smoking the Toro by Tola tonight, we're probably about a 6-inch cigar.
But it's still not overpowering.
No,
it is still smooth.
Thank you.
No, you're
right. It's smooth, but it's got a very good complexity to it. Yeah. It's got a little bite to it, but at the same time, it's not overpowering. It's got a really good spice going through it.
I agree with what Cody said. I'm getting a little bit further along. It has picked up an intensity, but not in any way. Is that a bad thing?
No. I mean, it's got a very toothy... That Mexican wrapper is very toothy, very chewy. I love it.
I'm becoming a really big fan of the Mexican wrappers.
You know what? At the Jose Blanco, the tasting seminar... When we got to the Mexican portion of that wrapper, which I was the only one in the room.
Oh, my God.
You want
to say this for like the next year?
Yeah, it's
going to
go on for about 10 years.
Hey, remember when we were at that Jose Blanco deal?
I was the only one out of 50 people there to recognize it as a Mexican wrapper.
Self-satisfactory plug!
But,
who be you?
We're going to get to that, because the waitress actually, in a minute, is going to bust out of there with it, demanding,
I made you!
Sorry, Toto, you got the earphones on. Right? Stop. We could go back to Brunson if you want.
I would prefer you go back to Brunson.
Who made you?
Now
you
did.
Who made you?
I shook you all night long.
You're cute.
Big gun, number one.
That's almost the way that scene went down.
It was very Bronson-esque.
Am I?
You're cute.
Am I?
I'm thinking Estevez just showed up and was like, okay, the director's on coke. I'm going to go out behind the Dixie stop every 30 minutes and blow a joint.
Yeah.
I will say this. I'm a huge fan of smoke production. I like I like a cigar that just pours smoke off of it. And this guy is burning. The wrapper's remaining just perfectly even burn line. And
isn't making me cry like when it was here last month and whatever we smoked was like German mustard gas.
Yeah, you got the real kind of acrid response.
All right, so here's because I had to actually relight this because I'm trying to do the trying to follow you, Senor Blanco. I'm trying to slow it down, trying to slow the pace down.
Arcade Nice AC/DC impersonations actually put the cigar out.
It probably did.
There's something wrong with it.
Oh, God.
What's up with
you? I slowed down to rely it, but at first I looked right into it.
Hmm.
Wait, something's wrong with my lighter.
What's wrong with his lighter?
So it's hard because I don't like relighting a cigar, so I keep chain smoking the damn thing. I don't know how to fix this.
Try to slow down.
That's a new theme for the evening. It. Something's wrong with the second floor of the pub.
Hold on, this glass isn't. Should I pour a pint over my head just for
laughs?
Something's
wrong with this cutter.
But I will say, I guess even at the midpoint, if I were in a tobacco shop and I saw this, I'd pick it up.
And I think the price point is very agreeable. I'm not quite sure where we're at price point, but I mean compared to some of the.
I don't know what the price is on this, but it's very agreeable.
Well, I think it's well under $8.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Which I can go with that.
If I get this. Anything under $8, I'm happy.
$6 to $8, and if I get this, I'm good.
I think we're in the $6 to $8 range.
All right.
So, and the beer, how we feeling about the beer?
Beer is very good.
Tut? Beer is very good. I'm already into it.
It's a good match with the cigar.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. We kind of pulled this together at the end, but yeah, it's pairing really well. So let's get back to the film.
One thing about the beer that I really like is that it's not a lot of aftertaste going through it.
No,
at least for me.
There's no aftertaste.
Yeah, it's just straight flavor from the drink. I'm not getting a lot of, you know, backlash into the flavor. I'm kind of digging it. To me, it's a good talking and drinking beer.
Yeah, it's got a little more up to it than like a, you know. Correct me, educate me. I'm going to make a horrible analogy here, but I'm comparing it to like a Guinness, which lingers on the palate after the sip.
Yeah,
this reminds me a little bit of Guinness, but it's done as soon as as soon as the sip's done, it's over with. Whereas Guinness kind of floats around on your tongue. And
I would say Guinness is a little bit creamier than this.
Yeah, it's much creamier.
Kiwi lime Mad Dog will do that too. That'll linger around for a while.
Well.
So a rattlesnake wine cooler.
Your wastebasket in your bedroom in high school knew a lot about how I felt about Kiwi Mad Dog.
That's a story for another time. Or later on in this podcast.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
And that wastebasket, so sick.
So,
no more.
Yeah, good beer. Good beer. And the cigar is, man, I just.
Yeah, the pairing of it's going
toothy,
really well.
That toothy Mexican wrapper, I mean, just the shine on that baby. And when I say toothy, the little kind of bumps you see on that.
Is that what they mean by toothy?
That's a toothy cigar.
So it's got texture to it.
It's got some texture to it.
Okay.
Correct.
I always kind of wondered what they meant by toothy.
This is toothy. What you guys are smoking is a toothy cigar.
Toothy.
And I love a toothy cigar.
I love a toothy cigar.
Toothy cigar!
Oh, damn.
Sorry. I tried to hold it back. Was that better? I
tried really.
You'd say that the accidental combination of the beer and the cigar worked out.
Yeah, it really kind of
did.
No, it really did, because the cigar adds that flavor from the drink. But like I said, the aftertaste isn't there, so it's not conflicting.
All credit
with the cigar.
Here goes to our beer master, Cody. He suggested 1554.
Yep.
And he thought it would be. I described the cigar to him and what we were doing, and he shot it out. So.
Now, quick question, is New Belgium, they're not the only ones in Fort Collins, are they?
They're the largest.
They're the largest?
Because
Fort Collins has a pretty good little craft scene going.
Yes.
And they have had for a while.
Well, they've legalized dope now, so who knows for how long.
It's going downhill.
The real money in Colorado now is in drive-through pizza joints.
They produce one keg a month. They could do more, but they're just kind of
not really
it
motivated like, anymore.
It
just harshes the vibe to do more than that, man.
Quotas, man. Quotas are lame.
Bean counters, dude. That's what you are, man. Just counting your beans.
That's all they are, man. Just brewing for the man.
So,
follow the money, dude.
At this point, everyone's in the diner. And actually, the trucks have not started circling yet. They're just kind of hanging around. The Green Goblin
taking
truck,
people out.
The Green Goblin made an attack.
Well, I thought that was the great one. Is that they basically goes out there and destroys the preacher's car.
Yeah,
like
totals
it. And you know, that's kind of the first scene where like everybody's like, "What's going on?" And of course, this guy runs out there. Going after the Green Goblin truck, like, and of course nobody knows there's nobody in it at this point yet. But I just find it hilarious that, I mean, it's not like these trucks are They're not race cars.
I mean, no,
when you see a big rig, like, even if it's, you know, steps on the gas,
it's
and
stationary. Does all, it's going to take a little while to get everything going.
That guy is just yelling at the back of the truck.
Yeah, yeah.
When he could clearly...
Oh, and the same thing is like, you know, even when he starts running, run to the left? No. Run to the right? No. I want to run exactly straight back.
But I think that's what gives gas attendant guy the idea that he could pull off numero dos in the history of worst mistakes. He's still blind from the gas in his eyes, but he wants to go out there and find his son, who's the bicycler that we're following someone. So he's like, you know what? I've got my keys. I'm going out there and find my kid. They hold up their finger like, he's passing no eye test. He can't see shit. But he's like, I got to do it. I got to go get my boy. So he...
I can't stand the quality of the acting anymore. I got to get out of here.
I got to get the fuck out of here. So he walks out, and immediately, once he gets out of the parking lot, he drops his keys.
Which was like, I'm going to reach in my pocket right now and throw my keys on the ground. Oh, I'm dropping my keys.
Boom. He's toast. Like big time toast. Like
and then my favorite thing is that I've got my feet planted straight on the ground. I'm going to freeze frame. Ah!
Oh, he did the scream too. Ah! And boom.
Was the music there for that one?
Yeah, I think they did.
Oh,
the
yeah.
Music.
Every
kind of gave it up later on, but
no, because,
the initial kills they really.
No, because even when they go back and the guy that I just mentioned,
Leon Rippey.
Dan. When he takes the ring off of the home chick and then the Green Goblin shows up.
Oh, they did do it at the end. Oh, that guy. Okay.
Yeah.
So he gets killed, and that's when the trucks begin circling as like sharks. Like sharks circling a raft. These things are circling this diner. And Curtis McCarthy, the Andrew McCarthy's brother and his newlywed, who are driving down the street.
I think the actor's name was like John Short.
It was Curtis McCarthy.
You almost pulled that off. I was like, Nick Cade's done some homework. We are meticulously researched here at the Cigar Club.
But they're still driving.
Curtis.
They're still driving. They're not quite to the diner yet. And this semi plows into the back of them. And classic, this is a great King dialogue, the only he could do. And only a relative of Andrew McCarthy could pull off. But they're driving, and that truck smashes back into him, and Yeardley Smith's like, oh my God! And they cut to Curtis McCarthy. Like, I think, what did he say? I think I just loaded my pants.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I just loaded my pants. And he's kind of just like, oh my God, it's hilarious. And it's just battering and battering. But at least when they wreck that car, unlike Tennis Short guy on the bridge, he rescues his wife.
Yeah.
The guy on the bridge, the chick in the bridge was Marla Maples, Donald Trump's ex-wife.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I didn't see that.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Because I was like, man, she's really cute. And then I saw what it was her. Who's also in one of our good films, Happiness. She's the real estate lady in Happiness.
I didn't remember that.
Yeah. But anyway, unlike Tennis Short guy, he rescues his wife and they make it into the dinner.
Actually, Emilio does, but at least he makes the effort.
He's there helping. Yeah. He doesn't run for it.
Yeah.
Like watermelon, Tennis Short guy.
And Emilio was just trying to run away. He got caught in front of the camera.
Yeah, well,
but that's when we lead to Emilio, and because remember the hitchhiker chick cuts the girl out with her switchblade
because
she's a
rough
and tough hitchhiker. And that leads to our second scene with Emilio and the hitchhiker, which is more painful than the first, where they talk about the knife and like, would you stab me or would you?
If I held you, if I put my arm around you, would you stab me with that thing?
And I'm just like, at this point, I'm really like, did Stephen King write this? This is so bad. This is painfully bad. Yeah, even good actors with a good director, this would be bad.
Yeah.
Stinks. This stinks.
Yeah. It's hard to defend
but
it.
But who even knows, and none of this was on IMDb, because no one would cop to it, I imagine, but who even knows, I mean... Can we even be certain? And the answer is no, we can't. Can we even be certain that there was a script for that scene?
Well,
yeah,
who
true.
Knows? If the director's coked up,
and he's just standing there with blood coming out of each nostril, just saying, "You guys just do what you need to do."
We skip right from that knife talk to them in bed together, post coitus, and the first thing she says, and this is when Jenny sat down next to me, unfortunately. She's like, oh, what are we watching tonight? It goes straight to their they just finished having sex. And she's like, you sure make love like a hero.
Oh, yeah. That was
hard. And that's like the number one rule in screenwriting. You don't spell shit out in dialogue. We've seen him be heroic. You don't need to...
So Jenny looked at Matt and went, well, we know no woman ever says that in real life.
Oh, no. I asked her why she doesn't say that to me more often.
And the silence was just...
Awkward silence!
Then my daughter walked out and talked stuff. And I'm like,
who made you? I made you!
No. Please, for the love of
sorry.
God.
Sorry. I'm going to use that one to get out of jams throughout the night. And then, did you guys notice this? After she calls, you know, you sure make love like a hero, and they're you know, nestled together. Did you notice he started, like, licking his finger and, like, going into her hair? And
dude,
like,
he was high off his ass.
But, dude, it was like a monkey picking bugs out of another monkey and eating them.
Right before they shot that scene, I guarantee you, he was behind the Dixie stop blowing one going,
did
Jesus Christ.
Did you guys notice that, though?
I did not.
He literally grabs her hair and, like, and, like, is, like, eating bugs out of her hair. It's the weirdest thing
he
I've
was
ever
high.
Seen.
Fucking when Charlie's in Cambodia making platoon right now. Fuck this shit.
And I like Emilio Estevez. I like a lot of Emilio Estevez stuff.
He's working with Oliver Stone, and I'm working with this coked up asshole.
Yeah, I think I was probably after the you
well,
make
I
love
think,
like
you know,
a hero.
I mean, a lot
line,
of people
was,
they probably signed
like,
up. I get to work with Stephen King.
I'm gonna work with Stephen King.
Yeah. You would think that would be a pretty good experience.
Some reason I just imagine Stephen King
who's
behind
that guy over
the
there
camera
the handkerchief
with a
to
giant,
his nose. That's Stephen
you
King.
Know, cocaine cowboy hat on. He's like, yeah, let's get this done,
dude. I don't know where he got the idea to pick. Pick grubs out of her hair and eat them. But it was so weird. And that's when Jenny got up. She's like,
we call that Fort Worth lovemaking.
She's like, you know, are you guys ever going to do a movie on the podcast that I might want to watch? I'm like, probably not.
Hopefully.
I think this is the norm. Emilio Estevez picking grubs out of a girl's hair and eating them. This is what we do. Somebody needs to talk about this.
Maybe this Breakfast Club flick I'm reading for will work out better.
So anyway, we cut to the next.
Was this before or after Breakfast Club?
Probably right around the same time. Breakfast Club might have come out a little bit earlier.
Yeah, I think I want to say this is after Breakfast Club. But man, Emilio Estevez is a good screenplay. He's so much more like his dad than Charlie Sheen.
I agree.
I saw so much Martin Sheen in this.
Yeah.
Just his mannerisms.
I just think he you know, I'm a big fan of the Young Guns movies.
Oh, yeah.
So he's
very good.
He's capable of delivering a good performance.
Yeah.
Here, he just isn't doing anything.
No.
I believe those were the Young Buns movies you watched.
Yes, they were.
Young Guns were the Westerns.
You never saw that. Oh, sorry.
But then again, that goes right back to the director. I mean, if the director's not able to pull it out, the actors start
Billy the Prick is not a real Western character from history?
Yeah, you know, he actually founded Stephen F. Austin University.
Oh, ouch.
Is that true?
Says the man who went to Sam Houston.
I know, well.
You know? I mean, I don't think the three of us can talk shit about any university.
At least my team lost to Utah in the first round. Good season, boys. Good season. Which, by the way, I have to admit, that was like the first college basketball game I've seen in a long time. That was so slow. Holy crap, that was slow.
Do you know the name of your school's mascot?
Before we lose our entire listenership with the talk of horrible schools playing in some ridiculous tournament, right after they have that post-coitus lovemaking scene, we go out to the diner where the trucker guy says a very poignant thing. I don't know if you guys caught this, but it's one of the more poignant lines of dialogue and thing. He says, the whole world's gone tits up. And I was like, AC/DC's playing on the pub stereo right now. How fortunate.
Yeah,
can you hear it over there?
No, I can't.
It's the highway to hell!
Sorry.
I think Tuttle's on the highway to hell right now.
I am definitely in hell.
But we go out to the diner. The guy says, you know what? It's like the whole world just went tits up. And that's when the waitress snaps.
I just love the expression tits up.
Dude, I love that. But that's a classic Stephen King phrase. That's him doing a country bumpkin, like only Stephen King. That phrase is just like, pure king. I'm like, I wish there was more of that. There's another one later where Emilio Estevez confronts the owner of the diner. He's like, you know what? You're the biggest fuckhead I've ever met.
No, but dude, his delivery is so much, it's so dead because he's stoned. So he's like, you're without a doubt one of the biggest fuckheads I've ever met.
That was pretty much spot on.
But at this point, they're just kind of beat and tired, and that's when the waitress just goes bananas.
I actually like this scene because that was actually...
Talk to me, X. Why do you like it?
Because I found her character annoying. I wanted her to get hit by a truck.
Hey, keep in mind, am I wrong? She was, where she would disappear, she was going back and screwing the diner boss, right?
I think so.
Every time they showed them walk out, they're buttoning up their clothes.
That wasn't in the screenplay, though. They were just fucking off camera.
Well, I don't know what was going on here, but every time they showed her...
Steven needs us for another shot. Okay, Bubba.
Every time they showed...
Bubba. Could you break character while you're making love to me? No, Bubba.
Every time they showed Wanda or whatever her name was and Mr. Hendershot, they were all walking out the back buttoning up their shirts. But she's finally had enough.
Pat Hingle, notorious lovemaker.
And she...
His lover. His confidant.
His confidant. His waitress. Lover. His waitress.
So she decides that she's had enough, and she storms outside.
She goes
and starts yelling at the trucks.
I love that pose she strikes.
She strikes a bold pose.
We made you.
But how dare you do this? We made you.
But now I think it does say something that you know, her and the truck stop owner are probably getting it on because out of nowhere. All of a sudden, they have a rocket launcher.
Well, once someone
goes to grab her, and next thing you know, Mr. Hendershot comes out with a rocket launcher.
That was hilarious because they do not explain that for a little while.
No, they
all
don't.
Of a sudden, I'm like, what the fuck?
No, that came out of nowhere.
Where does fucking Vietnamese rocket launcher come from?
She gets
that next to the corn nuts.
Oh no, we should say this. Here's how she gets killed. We neglected to say a roaming 50 caliber. Military
M60.
Is it M60?
M60.
An M60, Rambo 2 style?
Rambo 2 style, yeah.
Drives into the thing, and that's going to be their coercion to get them to pump gas for them. It's a military vehicle.
They call it like a mule, don't they? It's a mule
GM. It's basically just a movable platform.
Yeah, with this gun on top of it, and it shoots up the diner, and basically it's like, hey, if you want to live, you're going to pump gas for us. And this waitress has had enough, and it blows the shit out of her. And like all the deaths, it's a great death.
Yeah,
but she gets just.
I was going to say that scene when the M60 takes people out. Good work on the special effects there.
Very really good.
There was like three or four
Rip them in half. Yeah. I mean, it's great. But then I guess the Mr. Hendershot, the owner, sees that his piece of ass goes down. All of a sudden, the guy's got an RPG, and he's. Or what?
No. You're getting confused because Hendershot goes down in that scene as well.
Yeah. This happens before.
The rocket launcher
freaks
comes
out. She freaks
out
twice.
Oh, has he already used the RPG?
Yeah.
He had already used it because he blew up one of the trucks when she first freaks out.
Yeah. But then for some of it, then you're right.
Just like he likes his cigars, that other guy's right there behind him to reload a missile for him.
But my
jack of all trades, dude. You're gonna have to pay.
My question is that point is because
Joey.
because they use the RPG.
Get me again, Joey.
Because they use the RPG later. Why at that point didn't they just shoot them all with the RPG and kill them all?
I don't know.
Well, that's what
so protective of those missiles.
Well, that's what I couldn't figure out. Is like, you know, all of a sudden, all right, he's killing the trucks, and obviously these trucks, the semi-intelligent beings that they become, should be able to realize. Wait a second. Obviously, these people can destroy us, and so that's like when the gun mule thing shows up and starts firing at them. But it also begs the question, well, obviously, you know, it wasn't... I do recognize the weapon. The problem was, that's a single shot.
And it's going to run out of ammo.
It only has one shell. It's made... It's a self-contained thing. You fire it once, and then it's useless.
Right.
You can't reload it.
Well, maybe the aliens didn't know that.
Well, no, apparently nobody else did either, but I'm just saying.
Okay, so, well, she gets blasted for demanding that these machines, we made you. You need to stop this because we're your creators.
The stern talking to is what murderous death machines
need. Yeah, the stern talking to backfired horribly. But it did lead to the one scene that tried to give some insight, I think, into where King was going with all this. They're in the booths at night in the diner after she's dead and everything. It's at night. And the girl, the hitchhiker, asks Emilio, you know, when's it going to be our world again? And I think that's kind of when you get a sense that, all right, he is going for something here. What's our world? What's the world we could be? But it doesn't go any further than that. But then Estevez says, was it ever our world? But that's it. It's kind of left to you to kind of... It's very vague dialogue, which I'm okay with sometimes, but...
Well, see, that's one thing, and this might be off on a little tangent. You know, we just had a South by Southwest in Austin, and there was a group down there protesting against AI development and robots.
You say robots, we say no bots.
I mean, they were hardcore, you know, and even
Vince
like...
just pooped his pants at the start of this.
And even like, you know, Stephen Hawking's come out warning against AI, Elon Musk has come out warning against AI, but it just kind of, it's funny to
Bill
me because...
Bill Gates warned against it. Steve Jobs has warned against it.
We've been talking against AI since the 80s. I mean, it's just, it's kind of like climate change. We've been talking about that since 1911. It just, it's always going to be around. I always think that it's kind of fun to have that contemporary theme. But even like, you know, Terminator was talking about that with Skynet. It's just kind of like a cool little theme. But it's just, it's funny how when we look at today's technology world and how close we are to the actual warning, but yet we were really kind of feeling that even in 1980. And I think that was kind of funny. With our big bag cell phones.
And I think he was going for something there. It did not come across.
A little too weird there?
No, I think it's apt. I mean, it definitely fits that mold.
One of the things that King's done in a lot of the stories is he hinted at possible explanations in a lot of his short stories, but they never really came right out and said why. And I think in Trucks, they sort of hint at it too in the actual short story, but they never really come out and say this is... Obviously, from the beginning, they tell you we're in the tail of this comet, so that could be why things are going haywire, but it's like, right, we really aren't going to give you a cut-and-dry answer.
But in
happening.
The short story, Trucks, King flat-out says, when these people are thinking about running and getting into the woods, their end game is, well, what is that? We're going to be in a cave. We're going to be reduced back to cavemen, where we draw pictures...
Caveman hookers.
of ourselves and these trucks, because... These trucks are capable of laying road for themselves to get to us. The factories are capable of reproducing these trucks with their slaves.
I'm just saying it's better to live in a cave as a free man than work as a slave to Mack trucks.
But that was touched on much more so in the short story. Like, do we want to be slaves?
Yeah.
Are you willing to trade in? The minute we gas these fuckers up, we're their slaves. Do you want to live your whole life changing oil filters and pumping gas every time that thing blows its horn? What kind of life is that?
That beats my current gig.
Well, going back to the movie,
Nancy works at Arby's.
You know, getting back in there, we get to see, in terms of the world of within the movie universe, you come to find out that Hendershot has a basement full of weapons.
Well, and there was a very Dusk Till Dawn kind of thing. Like, he's accumulated this basement full of this arsenal of weapons that's never explained.
Yeah. And I thought...
That he refuses to use...
Truck stop stash armor.
Well, I'm like...
That he refuses to use in this moment of dire need.
Yeah.
I also failed to mention when the waitress gets blasted, she does make them... She does... As she gets blasted, she makes the... I think what we would agree is a horrible thing where she accidentally blows up the Miller High Life truck. It's like, oh no!
No!
That could have sustained you for like 5 months! It's 5 months of High Life.
In our case, 5 days!
Or in our case, it's 5 days of High Life in that truck.
Which, by the way, rest in peace to the Miller High Life spokesman.
Died. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Yes, I did. It
was very sad. 36.
I liked him. That was a good spokesman.
To the High Life guy.
To the High Life guy.
There were good commercials for the champagne and beers.
The shame and pain of beers.
We've all enjoyed Miller High Life ad nauseum.
I still like their bottles.
It's one of
pretty
our
pretty bottle.
Yeah, it's pretty bottle. It's one of our kind of go-to cheap beers.
It's a good football watching beer.
Oh, it's great football watching beer.
Good 70s themed party beer. I like it.
You know what? You're not going to win any friends in the snooty craft beer circle that...
Oh, you mean the hipster circle?
I didn't say that. I'm not criticizing your circle of friends you run with outside of Tuesday Night Cigar Club. But
I drink Miller Lite.
Hey, hell, I drink Keystone. You know what? I like a lot of...
I don't go that hard.
It's bottled beer tasting a can.
Not associate with him anymore.
I was about to say,
I'm losing the crowd.
Who made you? Oh. I made you. Drinking Keystone Homes.
Come on.
Bottle beer tasting a can. Personally, I like old Milwaukee.
Let's get back to the story.
Well, here's the thing. So the waitress gets blown to pieces. She kills the Miller High Life truck. The 50 calories in full effect. The kid, we still get a glimpse of this kid making his way. And I got, Mincy, you'll know what I'm talking about. I had a Mallrats moment where, God damn it, that kid is back in that creek.
He's back on that escalator.
There's a thing in Mallrats where Jason Lee keeps seeing this kid almost get killed in the mall. And every time I saw that kid, because I'd forget about him for 20 minutes.
He gets caught and a bloodbath ensues.
I'd be like, God damn it, that kid is back in that creek. Like, no one is helping this kid.
He's trying to get to his dad.
They would have done more with the lawnmower. That, I felt, was like a true scene.
Oh, and especially the way every time it would cut to one of the machines, you'd hear them.
Well, and that's the thing. They
did make some kind of like Jaws 3 noises.
They abandoned.
Like, you're not. At some point. Do that, but anyway.
At some point, we didn't even talk about the guy that got killed by a video game.
Oh, yeah.
We didn't talk about the guy that got killed by a video game in the arcade. Early on in the film, every electronic device...
Another professional actor. That was Giancarlo Esposito.
What's he from?
He's been in a ton of shit. He was in Pulp Fiction. He worked with... I think he was Paul the Bartender.
Oh, was he the bartender? Yeah. Good call.
Was that him?
He's been in a ton of stuff. He's been in like every Spike Lee movie.
Paul.
I recognize him from the Spike Lee movies.
He's been in every Spike Lee movie.
Okay. Well, we didn't mention that.
I didn't realize
he was in that movie Taps with the... Sean Penn and Tom Cruise.
Well, video game killed him in the arcade in the diner.
George C. Scott?
Yes.
The cutting knife wounded the waitress. We've seen all these electronics, but that's kind of abandoned later on. It just becomes about the vehicles. And before we get into the next brilliant dialogue between Emilio and what's the girl's name?
Road Twitch.
Brett?
Yeah.
I had to stop and literally go to my bookshelf and pull out Trucks, the story is based on, who's written by the same guy who supposedly wrote the screenplay. Listen to just one passage, the opening paragraph of the short story.
A
reading from Matthew Cade.
And scene.
The guys!
No, I'm not going to do it in AC/DC voice. I'll do it in Charles Bronson voice. No, here we go.
Soothing.
The guy's name was Snodgrass, and I could see him getting ready to do something crazy. His eyes had gotten bigger, showing a lot of the whites, like a dog getting ready to fight. The two kids who'd come skidding in the parking lot in the old Fury were trying to talk to him, but his head was cocked as though he was hearing other voices. He had a tight little pot belly encased in a good suit that was getting a little shiny in the seat. He was a salesman, and he kept his display bag close to him like a pet dog that had gone to sleep.
This dude is a good writer!
Yeah.
He's a great writer.
Yeah, see, he was only drinking heavily then. This was before the cocaine.
Is that what it was?
Yeah. He used to just drink beer all day.
The vices changed?
Yeah. You read On Writing. He admits, like, but he said by 1985
like
I was into cocaine.
Good artists, they need one substance to fuel them.
When you mix one more in. Like Guns N' Roses, the first album they were all drunk. By the second time, coke entered and they're all over the place. Okay, maybe that's it. Listen to this one. The girl in the booth screamed, both hands were clamped into her cheeks, dragging her flesh down, turning it into a witch's mask.
That is fucking great descriptive writing. He did none of that in this movie.
No.
I got one more. Outside, all the headlights suddenly popped up and on in unison, bathing the lot in an eerie, deathless glare. Growling, they cruised back and forth. The headlights seemed to give them eyes, and in the growing gloom, the dark trailer boxes looked like the hunched, squared-off shoulders of prehistoric giants.
Did you get any of that? I imagined him looking at the script going, let's look at the source material. I don't know who wrote this. This is crazy. We can't do this.
He pulled a Kubrick.
This source material.
This short story sucks. It's got your name on it. It sucks. I didn't write this shit.
It's just toilet paper.
You know what? From what Menzies told us about the substance abuse and from what I've known about, you know, I guess we have to attribute, but he's so adamant in that trailer that I am going to show you what a Stephen King movie is all
about.
Anybody's on
coke when they're shooting the trailer, and if we get the
moment. Well, yeah, his eyes are like.
To go back to my.
He looks like Andrew McCarthy in that trailer.
To my limited time.
I will scare you.
To my limited time in the pictures. Whether we were working on something that we did in a day, or whether we were working on a feature that we took weeks to do, it's extremely hard for me to imagine the director of a film being high on cocaine. Unless, because it was shot in 1985, everybody else was high too. That's the only thing I could think of.
I don't know. I'm gonna give it up to that because I don't know any better.
There's a lot that's
gonna
be
attributed
to that.
Did anybody else notice that once the Brett, the hitchhiker, who was really cute early on with her hair up, she was kind of a tomboyish.
Yeah.
Did anybody else notice when she let her hair down, she had Tuttle hair?
Yeah, she went to the Adrian Barbeau.
Did you see that?
I was expecting.
I was like, oh God, Tuttle's going to hate her now because she's got
again,
Tuttle hair.
Again, though, at that point,
how the next Photoshop experiment.
How many joints has she burned with Estevez by that point?
I'm going to be the freaking truck shop
all
girl.
I could see at that point was when she let her hair down, I'm like, that's Tuttle hair. I can only see Tuttle's face.
And like I said, after last week or the last
episode. I can't watch 80 Cinema now because I see your face and everything.
After the last episode, I had to get a haircut. I was like, I can't go into this.
You saw it too?
Yeah.
That first shot where it's coming down, I did. Oh my God, Tuttle's going to freak
out.
Straight
up,
perm. I bet he liked her up until now.
I did. Yeah.
And then it.
Yeah. Yeah, when she does that scene where she's pumping gas and she does the. That weird stone, I thought she was moving in to kiss the dude. And she was
There's not a whole lot on her IMDb page after this.
I hope they choke on it.
The weird thing when I looked at IMDb was she was 6 years older than Yeardley Smith in this movie. The newlywed chick. Who I thought...
Really?
That kind of blew me away. I was like, I thought she was much younger, you know. I think Yeardley Smith has that older... She's always had that kind of older face, I guess. But that kind of surprised me. But, once the waitress is dead, they decide to become gas slaves. They make the...
They don't really have the choice.
There's not a lot of debate about it. Well, in the book, they have no choice because they bring in a cat bulldozer and start demolishing the place. They have to do
it. Well, they do that in the movie as well. They took Bubba's car.
I think they make that call much more easy in the movie. But you get a sense that this Estevez has... At least I got a sense Estevez had a plan. Like, hey, just...
Well, that was my problem.
He's tapping the trucks on the side. Like,
I got a bag of weed that itch.
You're full. Let's go.
That's my point.
Well, I'm sitting here going, you're a truck stop full of guns. I know if you're a truck stop...
Why aren't they using those guns?
Well, the other thing was, and apparently they had grenades.
They had grenades.
When the diner owner went down there, Estevez, this is like a half hour before now, he grabs that M60, like the Predator, like Dutch's Predator with the rocket launcher. He's like, we're doing this our own. But then he doesn't. He leaves it there. You never see those guns again.
Yeah.
And that's what I can't... There are certain just, a lapse in logic there. If nothing else, you can shoot out their tires.
Or use the grenades to take the bulldozer off its track.
Their trucks, their fuel tanks are exposed. They're like right on the side of the body.
And that's
high powered rifles will go right through that.
And that's when Estevez's Billy
may not blow it up, but all the gas will leak out.
And that's when Billy has the one poignant, somewhat giving us a glimpse into what King's going for here. His one poignant speech with the chick, finally, where he's exhausted from pumping gas for like 24 hours straight. And he starts talking about brooms.
Yeah.
Brooms.
It was kind of explained.
The aliens are here. Because they're outside of, or in the book or in the sequel, it's made clear they're outside Area 51. They're in North Carolina in this one, so I don't know where aliens came into play necessarily. But he's like, the aliens are using the trucks as brooms to sweep the humans off the planet to make way for an alien invasion. Okay, at least that's the first glimpse we've got at an MO for what's going on, and. you know, I welcome that. I was like, all right, you know what? That's actually
that makes a lot of sense. It gives a little context.
You know, we only have 10 minutes in the movie left, but at least you gave us an alien thing to kind of go by.
The gas pumping scene is bittersweet to me because I think it's like one of the best scenes in the entire movie. I love it when Hell's Bells kicks in, and it's just a cool little 80s
You only picked this movie because
deal.
Of AC/DC.
I did.
It's becoming more and more unclear every second. We just basically watched an hour and a half AC/DC video.
Note to self, any movie Tuttle will watch so long as it has AC/DC.
Pretty much. You put AC/DC
in. Do you like Last Action Hero?
I loved Last Action
Hero.
And it sucks because the only way you can get that song, Big Guns, is through the Last Action Hero soundtrack.
You've been Turtle Shock!
Well, it's a great soundtrack. The Last Action has a great soundtrack.
Yeah, it is.
It's got that song.
I really did.
But the one thing that I hate, I actually hate about that gas scene,
reason,
is when he's leaned up next to the green monster, and he's all, I got the best stuff on the East Coast, practically uncut.
What did we talk about last week? Was last week with Escape from L.A., when he was talking to the president, when the president was talking to his wife, and she was like, I'm like, that was so goofy and out of place, and I mentioned Last Man Standing.
Yeah.
The whole movie's serious, and then he gets on that switchboard, and he's like, hey, dudes, I'm on the... It's like these weird moments that just...
Yeah, that's
when
a,
he goes up to that Green
analogy.
Goblin truck, and he's like, I got the best uncut shit you can get.
Got the best stuff on the East Coast.
I guess it was meant to be funny.
But it was so corny.
It was so corny. It's a corny movie, but that was a different kind of.
But career. I did like the reveal when a home chick goes out after she's pumped gas and she goes out to the road and she kind of throws her arm up on the truck and camera cranes up, shows all the trucks lined up on the road. I thought that shot
looking down the turnpike or whatever of just endless trucks, and it's like this is their life from now on, and they are slaves. That was a good.
Yeah,
that was a really good.
There's
moment.
A lot of good cinematography points.
There's a lot of bad cinematography. There's a lot of weird zooms. Yeah. Like, I'm panning and I want to get to there, but I'm running out of time, so I'll just move it and zoom. Like weird rushed camera movements, which there might be a reason for that, which I'll get to in a minute. As someone who's done cinematography, you should have an opinion on this. But we'll finish.
I was
up.
Say cocaine, but
someone's done cocaine.
Well, let's finish up this first. We're almost there.
Just
so
left the cocaine.
So basically,
cocaine's a hell of a drug.
Trucks destroy the Dixie Boy. Everyone's on foot. They are armed. They finally get some guns, and they're on foot. But you know, they had the Dawn of the Dead ending, basically, where they're like, if we get to a boat,
get to
an island. They have an island where there's no cars allowed, and the movie ends with them getting to the pier. The Green Goblin makes one last, even though it was blown to smithereens, makes one last kill, one last move, and they have the RPG, and they blow it, and they get off in the boat, and the movie ends with them going to this island, which is Dawn of the Dead ending, basically. We're going to start a new life on this island. I like the ending. I like that it wasn't wrapped up, like everything just died. The machine, the comet left, and
they wrap it up. They say the Russian,
the voiceover thing, or the Russian happened to have a laser blaster on its satellite, took out a UFO, and
well, at that time, you know, there was the whole Star Wars thing going on, so there
which
was
just doesn't make any sense, and that was the inconsistency is the trucks came alive, but the cars didn't come alive.
There was so much inconsistency. Some people's cars worked, some people's didn't.
Yeah, like
some,
the newlyweds.
Some electronics worked,
cocaine.
Some didn't.
Cocaine. Again, cocaine.
You got to give it up to cocaine. It's a hell of a drug, apparently. I mean, that's the only reason, right, Mitzi?
Well,
he's a smart guy.
The inconsistency is like what
I don't think
constitutes.
He would make the movie that way now.
As I was
sober.
Saying earlier, I think it's a good bad movie.
It's a bad movie,
but it's entertaining.
He's a smart enough guy where if he had a sober mind, he would make these mistakes.
No, yeah. and
it may be a bad movie, but
it also chalks up to there's a difference between a novelist and a director. In a novelist, you have carte blanche to do anything. But if you're not used to directing people, if you're not used to interacting
with
people...
There's so much that goes into it. You know that better than anybody. It's not just being able to tell a story. Like I said, he can tell a story. He can articulate what he wants to see. But when it comes to, you know, tying everything together and being able to coax performances out of younger actors and things of that nature, that's just something that he might not be able to do that sober. Who knows? But there's just a lot lacking there from just being high the whole time.
And that's what I kind of walked away from, is that the story, I love the story. Now,
it's a campy, fun sci-fi story. Yeah. I'm all for a simple sci-fi.
I can totally see him directing somebody and just giving him, like, do that, and that's it. And he had nothing.
The 80s were...
You couldn't ask him questions. You couldn't come back to him and say, Steve, can I do this? Can I do that?
We can sit here and name 80s sci-fi movies that were simplistic and nothing deeper going on, that on a very simple premise, like an alien invasion or something. The Stuff. The Thing. A little more heady.
Night of the Creeps.
But what gets me in any movie is inconsistency in your logic. You have to make me believe in the rules of your movie.
Yes.
And this movie had no rules.
Yes.
Some things turned against you, some things didn't.
You've never done it before, and you've never studied the craft, and you don't know anything about what directing a film is about, these things are going to happen.
Yeah.
But you sure were good at criticizing the fuckers that directed your stuff.
Yeah, Cooper.
Like I said, that was when he was just on beer.
And you know what? I give it to him. He's just, he had to learn the hard way. And it sounds like maybe he's got a little bit of buyer's remorse in that he's like,
He said it was a learning experience.
What I was going to say was, you know, so that's the end of the movie, and there's some other stuff we'll get into, but the cinematographer, I don't know if you guys knew this, the cinematographer, during the lawnmower scene, when the lawnmower was chasing the young boy.
Oh, yeah, I did know that. Yeah.
It was a remote-controlled lawnmower. Everything, the trucks were remote-controlled. That was a big thing when, you know, you think there's just maybe a midget down there driving underneath. Well, we can't say midget.
Oh, not this again.
There was a little shit down there.
You know. Oh, not this again.
No, there was a gnome down there. No, wait, gnomes are magical. What'd you say they were? What are gnomes?
Gnomes?
You said they were little magical creatures?
Yes, a gnome is a tiny garden.
All right, the dude from the R2-D2 can was down there underneath the lawnmower pulling switches.
I'm not pulling you out of this
little
one.
People. I thought maybe they had little people down there working the wheel and the gas pedals, but no, they were all remote controlled. And when apparently they had a lot of issues with those, so when that was a big shooting thing, they would have to stop and start, because when one truck's remote control went out, they all, you know, it was a big clusterfuck. But the remote controlled lawnmower, which you don't see do any damage, you see the boy and you see it start chasing him, and that's it. But apparently, that remote-controlled lawnmower, when they set it off after the boy, it came across a rogue chunk of wood in a lawn and started spitting out wood chips out of it. One went into the DP's eye.
Oh!
Took out his eye. He lost an eye.
Oh, dang.
The director of photography lost an eye on this. Sued King for what, 18 mil?
Sued him for 18 mil, and supposedly they settled out of court.
But the fucking camera guy in this movie lost his eye for this movie.
I'm guessing if they settled out, it was for less than 18 mil, which King probably had. It was probably easy to pay somebody off at that point in his life.
You lost an eye making this movie.
No, I'm not from the...
Not The Shining.
Was Ranuzzi was his name? Anthony Ranuzzi.
Yeah, it was an Italian... but dude, you didn't lose it making The Shining. That'd be one thing to talk about in a bar. Like, hey, buddy, what's with the eye patch? Cinematographer on The Shining.
I was Mo Green's extra in The Godfather. When they shoot him through his glasses, I lost my eye. Oh, awesome. Lost your eye?
Apocalypse Now. I was the Oh, wow. No shit. Would you lose? No, I lost my eye on Maximum Overdrive. Which, by the way, they say in the movie. Remember her?
That's another my pet peeve.
I forgot to mention that. She says things are great.
Kate and I get huge kicks out of when they mention
that movie. No, tell me this, too. Every time they mention the name of the movie in the movie... But dude, hers is best. Like, everything was fine around here until all the machines went into Maximum Overdrive.
Dude, I saw the worst one ever last weekend.
I had to totally stop and just give the She said it.
Kate had told me to watch Skyfall because I hadn't seen it yet.
Great movie.
And it was good, and it got me on a James Bond kick. So I'm going back watching all these old Roger Moore ones, and I watch.
When she's like, "That guy's got thunderballs."
That was a different movie.
Oh, that was a different movie. Sorry.
It was a...
He's going to moonrake us over this whole damn... Oh, no.
It was in a...
I have a view to a kill.
Well, that's what they said. It was a view to a kill.
Oh, they do say
and
it.
And they're up... It's Christopher Walken and Grace Jones are up in his blimp, his Mac Zorn blimp flying over San Francisco. And they're talking about how they're planning to flood Silicon Valley. And she leans over and she goes, "What a view." And he leans in and goes, "To a kill." And I was like, oh, yeah. Oh God, that's awful. That's just awful.
Great Bond movie,
though. I was like, that's worse than when Tom Sizemore says Saving Private Ryan. It's just terrible.
Oh, does he say it? I never saw that movie.
If only we could, because maybe Saving Private Ryan's the one good thing we could do out of this mess.
Did you do it in the theater when Saving Private Ryan, like, you said it?
No, I got it walked out.
I do walk out when they say the name of the movie in the movie.
Maybe if we can stop these children of the corn.
We'll get to Children of the Corn here in a minute. But I remember sitting in the theater and they're like, "This is Ghoulies 4." And I'm like, "Come on, we're out. Get your popcorn. We're fucking out of here."
When I was hungover on that snow day watching Total Recall, I was like, "She said he didn't remember jack shit. That's an hour. An hour from now, he could have Total Recall."
Yeah, never say the name of your movie.
This Apocalypse Now will haunt us all. It just doesn't make any sense.
Stop it.
But yeah, the DP lost his eye during this movie, which is deplorable.
Well,
that it could happen.
Depending on when they shot the lawnmower scene, that explains a lot.
What, the drug abuse and the...
No, just like some scenes were like really good and just beautiful, and then other scenes
were...
Oh,
no, there were scenes with...
White balance was off, focus was off.
Well, you had mentioned some camera stuff, but there's some close-up shots of Emilio and her in bed where his face is completely out of focus. And I guess it's looking... You know, I don't know if it kept working. I don't know if it kept working with
it's
one
not my
eye.
Fault. I can only see 2/3 of the
It looks fine to me.
Meanwhile, Stevens over there.
Looks good.
Brent. Everything on the left side of the frame is out of focus. No, it's fine. Are we good?
The DP saw him as right, yeah, and Kate was seen on his left together. That's what you got.
I don't know when that happened in the process. Maybe
it's horrible.
It is horrible.
And so are we.
But you know what? He's a sad millionaire now. So
I don't know. I can look out of the right side. What do you think, Steve? What? It's good. Rap.
Yeah.
When's lunch?
Well, one of the things that it was funny because, and this might just be my sensitivity coming through. The one thing that I really hated about...
You're sensitive.
I am. And I really hated the portrayal of Southern people in this movie. It was just so... God damn it, Bubba! I'm gonna get everybody
that is
from
Keen
North...
because he's a dyed-in-the-wool Yankee. And that's he thinks...
He loves Maine, and it's surprising that they didn't have this movie in Maine.
That's why I actually kind of caught that. I was like, you know, I wonder if it's
his
Maine
deal.
For
movies that aren't done in Maine, I'm going to throw a real obscure one out here, but it's another great example. Remember The Mangler? No, not The Mangler. Night Shift, or Graveyard Shift with the rats.
Yeah.
It was a southern factory, and the guy from Tremors, Fred...
Ward?
Fred Ward was the foreman there, but he's a horrible Southern guy. Like, yeah, he I think he's guilty portraying Southerners.
He can stomach one of his 1,000-page novels. He wrote that one 11/22/63 a few years ago, where the guy finds
the Kennedy book.
Yeah, he finds that like it's present day, and it's like this 35-year-old school teacher, and he finds out that this diner that he eats in, the guy has a time machine in the back of it where you walk through a door. And it transports you back to 1959. And so the whole thing is he thinks he can stop the Kennedy assassination, so he goes to Texas. And King's portrayal, I think Colleen gets a shout-out in there. But the whole thing is he and it's supposed to be Dallas-Fort Worth in 63, which I imagine is a lot different today, but he actually says in like the foreword or the afterword, he says something about it. He's like, "You might be able to tell from reading this I'm not from Texas, and I couldn't be prouder of that fact." So he's very much a dyed-in-the-wool Yankee. Yeah. He's got this idea that we're all still down here fighting the Civil War.
From the diner owner to the trucker.
Literal cokehead.
I mean,
go back to Cokachusetts.
We should do a podcast from Cokachusetts. I hear they got good wings.
But no, that was one of the things.
No, but you know what? I'm
with
you on that.
Like, come on,
it was
dude.
Mitt Romney loving pinko liberal.
God damn it, Joey.
You know what? What Maximum Overdrive should be a good example. It's not, but what it where it I think capsulizes a lot of his other stuff. I read an interview with him. I was telling you guys earlier. It was an interview by a guy named Bob Stewart. B H O B is how he spells Bob.
Bob?
So I don't know that dude's not from Austin.
Yeah, I don't know if it's Bob. Yeah, you know what? He's probably totally from Austin. It's Bahab.
Robert R. Or it's Hob.
It's Hob. The first B is silent.
It's silent.
Anyway, Bahab Stewart did a really good interview with him. I'm trying to give the guy a shout out, but come on, spell your name right. Where he said, he comes to the king, he's like, you know what, it seems to me, reading your books and leading into Maximum Overdrive, that Stephen King takes the most preposterous situation you can dream up. Imagine the most preposterous situation you can possibly imagine, and then you set out to convince people, the reader, that it's plausible. And that applies to almost everything Stephen King does. And Stephen King said, yes, you nailed it, that's what I do. No bigger example than my favorite short story of all time, The Mist. I got this idea for setting the situation in a grocery store where these huge bugs, he loved Empire of the Ants and these old sci-fi creature features. He's like, where can I put these people in the most normal, everyday situation in a grocery store? And bring in these huge fucking bugs and make people believe it.
Well, and the idea for it came, he said that there had been, it was same situation, he was young, he'd published the first couple books, they had one kid, and he said they had him and his wife had a house on the lake, and they went to a grocery store, and he said, and it was after there had been a huge storm and people didn't have power for a day, and he said, and I was just in there to buy hot dog buns. He said, I'm in there with my 5-year-old son, and I'm seeing all these people in these long lines. I mean, he said that's one of his pet peeves when people ask him, how do you come up with this idea? He said, I don't know, they just happen. He said, I'm in the store, these long lines of people, tourists, and I'm there with a roll of hot dog buns, and I'm thinking, all of a sudden I think, what would happen if some giant prehistoric creature came through the window and started killing everybody?
That's what he does. He thinks of just the most preposterous situation, and then he rolls with it. And that's why The Mist was so fucking good.
I say this, though, and the truck story does it, and the movie does it
Lawnmower Man, one of my other favorite short stories.
Yeah.
Which we'll get to when we talk about disappointing cinematic translations of Stephen King's work. Or just entirely misleading in that case. But you look in the ads in the paper for someone to mow your grass. We've all been there. And this dude shows up and immediately strips down naked, starts mowing your grass naked, this fat, greasy bastard, and you're looking out your living room window at this naked guy mowing your grass, you know, and then he gets down on his knees and starts eating.
The mower goes on automatic, he just gets down and eats the grass.
He gets on his knees and starts eating the grass clippings. And you're like, the guy's got green juice dripping down his face, he's naked, it's all over his body. And then you start calling the cops, and all of a sudden the lawnmower kicks in your front door, and this guy comes in.
That yard looked great.
Well, he didn't edge.
Well, no, all his good stories and novels, anything good in horror and sci-fi, he's the best at it in the stories. It puts you in that situation. The ultimate, that's what always sucks me into it, and I say this was a good experience as a story or movie. You think, what would I do? If I were in that grocery store in The Mist, what would I do? If I were in this truck stop, what would I do?
He's brilliant in the way that he can put you in that moment, give you something to relate to, whether if you have a kid or a wife or something, or your job. He can get you to where you can relate to that main character.
You mentioned Dawn of the Dead, too.
Why are you giving me the gas face?
Because, like, books that I remember most from Stephen King, and I can't remember the name of it, was this chick who was, like, handcuffed to a bed.
Gerald's Game.
Was it Gerald's Game?
Sex toy gone wrong. The husband dies, and she's trapped to the
bed. Great. So I'm remembering that because I was put in that situation.
Well, you're remembering one of his least successful novels of all time. Okay.
Your husband died and left you
Carrie. Everyone knows that freak at high school that was an outcast, who was picked on, who, you know, any day where that man or girl, the boy or girl snapped, was not going to be a shocker because she was completely humiliated every day of her life.
What would I do if I were there?
What would I do?
You mentioned Dawn of the Dead, perfect situation. I'm in the mall with these people. What would I do? You know.
Real quick, before we get a little more into King and...
It's one of my reoccurring nightmares, by the way.
Before we get in...
Being trapped in the mall with Ving Rhames?
Before we get into the... You know, Maximum Overdrive was remade. We'll get into that in a little bit more. You finish your cigar. Cody and I are You're going a little bit slow on this.
I'm following the advice.
He's slow burning.
Somebody listened to Jose Blanco and is going slow. And are you reaping the rewards of that?
I think I am. This is mellow. I mean, as you know, I'm not a fan by any means. This has really changed the flavor. It's it's really mellow.
It definitely got bolder in that last third.
I loved it. The Emilio AF1, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Beautiful. It was a really good cigar.
Yeah, I dug it. I definitely would look for that again.
Yeah. I mean, totally.
Thumbs up. Cody and I are still going. I'm giving it a big thumbs up.
Yeah, big time thumbs up.
Just everything that I've noticed. I mean, just observation. I mean, the construction for everybody. I didn't see anybody's splinter. It was awesome.
The only relights were done due to conversation.
Yeah.
Just because we've been talking.
Yeah.
The smoke outpouring is phenomenal.
Copious.
Yeah, and you kind of hit the one of the reasons why I like the Liga series is because that smoke, the way it rolls off the cigar. It was very, very similar.
Thank you.
But not only that, it was the taste as well. The taste was really, really nice. Had a little earthiness to it. Had some spice to it. It was just, it was nice complexity all the way through.
It never reached full strength. It's maintained medium.
Yeah.
You know what? The more I smoke cigars, the more I appreciate construction. Because so many good cigars, I've noticed, you know, kept under. You always got to factor in outside factors. But, you know, I'll take a cigar out of my humidor where I know the temperature and the humidity has been perfect. And if it starts unraveling on me or it starts doing something catawonk, I know it's not me. I know I've let them rest. These guys, we got these submitted to us maybe a month ago, 6 weeks ago. They've been resting for about 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And construction spot on. And the fact that Cody's enjoying it, knowing this is a step above where he goes.
Oh, yeah.
That's a bold statement. And, I'm looking forward to smoking some other Emilio stuff.
Yeah, I'm it's on my radar now.
The Tobacco Junction here in Temple, down the street, their cigar of the month last week was it the House of Ezron? Is that Ezron cigar? But that's also under the House of Emilio.
Yeah,
That was a second Hobbit sequel, the House of Ezron.
I got to be honest with you, I gave up on the Hobbit series after none of them. I didn't watch one.
Thanks for laughing. That almost flew over badly.
I watched the first two.
Mincy, maybe sit a few plays out for a while.
You know what?
I don't respect a film that doesn't last as long as this podcast.
Then why are we...
So basically, you only like the Apocalypse Now Redux.
Pretty much. I like the six-hour epics.
No, you don't. You bitch nothing about Once Upon a Time in the West. It's a great smoke.
It really was.
And the beer, and it went hand in hand. I can't say enough about the beer. I was a little, I'll be honest, a little hesitant to go here because when Cody threw out that it was in between the porter and the brown ale that we were supposed to do, the Texian, the spinning mule.
Yeah, it didn't really do much for me,
and I was kind of scared off towards things that might borderline a porter more cigar or beer.
I just go back to Itchy the Mouse as Butler. I don't know what's in them. I just don't know. I can't stop drinking them. Here's your beer, Mr. Itchy.
But the porter. I drank it slow and it. It didn't do a lot for me.
I don't know if that was because I so badly wanted to stop during the Shining bit.
I think that's a big thing that we talk about is the beer not working in conjunction? Was it when you pair stuff, no beer, no TV, make all parties something culpable?
Well, yeah, when you're doing a pairing, yes, it is. You can have a good cigar that pairs with a crappy beer or a good beer that pairs with a crappy cigar.
And I don't know if when we did the Smoking Monk Porter and the Spinning Mule Porter, was it the cigar was dragging down the beer? Was the beer dragging down the? I don't know.
Well, it also depends on the type of porter as well, because you know there's different flavor ranges within just the porter brand itself. That's one thing that was kind of funny with the Hefe that we did, because we didn't do a true Hefe. We did like the crossover between
it was
the Hefe and the wheat
mix. kind of a new breed Hefe with the Belgian white and
the vice versa, which I loved. That beer. Good beer. And that's what's kind of making me curious about the new Belgium. What's the beer again?
1554.
Hey, we didn't select this beer. I didn't have my notes. The 1554 that I like is that you're bordering between that porter and a brown ale, so it's kind of opened my own mind about trying crossover beers or trying those beers that kind of try to straddle both lines. Normally I'd be like, I don't want to do that, but this is two beers in a row that have tried to do that. What first would, the Hefe and Wheat, and then the second the
Cody,
brown ale.
What would the 1554, if you were to characterize it? You know, what is this? What kind of beer would you...
This is a black ale.
Is that a small subset of beers? Like, do a lot of beers... Is that a category that...
Well, ale encompasses a... It is just an umbrella.
Yeah.
But black
is part of the brewing process of combining the malts primarily or what are going to give this its flavor. Like I said earlier, they had put in a lager yeast for the fermentation. The hops, I'm not familiar with the hops. Starts with the T. I can't think of it at the moment. But like I said, the hops are not overpowering. It's not an IPA. They're trying to get everything to go in together very smooth. There's pale, there's black, there's chocolate malts in here. One of their brewmasters worked on this recipe himself. I believe he actually went to Belgium and worked on getting this recipe off of older, you know.
Well,
I don't know if I'll go so far as to say ancient, but you know,
well, older. It's a good beer.
Yeah,
it's a good fucking beer, and you can drink it, and it's not boring.
No,
and I think it goes well with. Is it your follow up cigars? Is it treating you just the same?
Yeah,
that's a good sign.
Yeah,
switch cigars, and it's a good sign. Real quick, they did remake in 1997. Pretty short turnaround, 11 years for a remake, but USA...
Not when everyone had forgotten the original movie.
Correct. But USA...
I liked it back in the 80s.
I know, and that's why we're here. That's why we're doing this.
Hey, brother. Me too.
USA Channel did a television remake called Trucks. I did not converse with any of you boys beforehand. Did any of you get a chance to watch Trucks?
No. I got about the first 5 minutes.
That's it.
And that first 5 minutes captured me. I want to finish it.
I had seen part of it a long time ago.
Because it started off more so than... There was no explanation. There was no like, oh, let's put this placard up giving you premise.
There's no comment. There's no...
It just...
By the way, the beginning of Maximum Overdrive, the planet Earth and the thing was very EC Comics. It was very cartoonish.
Yes. Yeah.
Very Creepshow-ish.
Yeah. Right.
The planet did not look like Earth. I mean, it was a very cartoonish.
It was a globe in space.
Globe in space, which I guess that should have been your first inclination that he's going to go campy with this. And the green glow of the comet over the whole movie was very EC Comics. Very, you know...
Well, it does give you that, as opposed to saying, like, we don't know what's going on. Why is, you know, you're in the middle of, you know, Carolina going, why is the sky green at night?
Well, the Coke he did that day was cut with a little too much sweet and low, so...
Well, the sequel...
everything was
unlike the original, the sequel did take place around Area 51.
I want to see this green sky. What green sky?
So immediately...
Blue as could be.
Immediately they tried to bring in the alien presence. There's a... Good lord. Our bartender Nada is gyrating and...
But I liked the opening of Trucks.
And she's wearing, if you notice, Sylvester Stallone's shirt from Expendables 3.
Oh, so lucky. Love that wardrobe.
But they immediately went into the alien factor in Trucks. But what they also did was they limited it to Trucks. where, yeah, unlike Maximum Overdrive, they didn't have any kind of electronic devices going crazy. It was just strictly...
No one got killed by a pinball machine.
It was strictly trucks. Until there was like a 10-minute window in trucks. The lead hero, we've replaced Emilio Estevez with Timothy Busfield, who's Poindexter from Revenge of the Nerds.
I like that.
No.
And Sacco from Striking Distance.
I'm totally going to have to watch this now.
Who?
And Sacco from Striking Distance.
And Sacco from Striking
Distance. Hey, Artie, you asshole!
The acting is no better. You know who the lead is? Is that Brenda Backey? She plays the real sultry,
oh yeah,
heavy voice from Hot Shots Part 1.
No, 2.
2.
The
smoky voice, oh, the one, yeah, that... With the fake mole.
That was one of the things that intrigued me. Now, but I just...
Oh, she's so
the thing
sexy.
I like about trucks, like I said, I saw like the first 5 minutes.
Go on.
It goes...
She's so sexy! No.
A lot of editing on sound.
You've been turtlestruck!
I can't edit this.
Well, she's great. But what they do is...
This will never be viewed.
It's all trucks in this one. Trucks are killing everybody. Trucks are doing it all.
You mean it's a normal podcast.
Trucks are killing everybody. But there's two times in the movie. One, a mailman gets attacked by a toy truck. Like a remote-controlled little toy truck. Keeps bashing him in the legs. And at first he's like annoyed, like, whoever's working this remote, get out of here. But then it keeps bashing him to a point like where it breaks his ankle. And then it starts bashing him in the face. And it's like, oh, okay, they're incorporating some other things.
I know what I'm doing tomorrow. Watching trucks.
But they never go further than that. But then there's another thing where these two yokels are working the hazmat team to come in. Because supposedly there's a nuclear waste leak that's causing this. But they never go into that. Nothing's ever explained. But these two idiots driving this hazmat truck get into a wreck. And all of a sudden, you see in the back of the hazmat thing, an air hose comes out the back, blows up a hazmat suit in the back. So, like the white hazmat suit, it inflates it. And this inflated hazmat suit grabs an axe and sticks it in the driver and then hacks another dude to pieces. Nobody in it, just an animated hazmat suit. But then they never explore that again, like other things. Like
idiot yokel sounds like roles you and I were meant to play. Especially in the Stephen King universe.
Damn it, Tuttle! What in the hell? Put that hatchet down! Well, it had bad truckers, too, but they were just totally forgettable.
There's a hazmat suit on the road,
holy shit!
I'm not so promising about this movie. The first 5 minutes were great. You know, out of nowhere, a truck just
we would rock that
runs
scene.
Over a dude in his back.
There's a moment in Trucks where they're trying to decide whether to go out or stay in the diner. And there's that moment, a very brief moment in Maximum Overdrive, where it's like, do we gas them up or do we not? And it made me really appreciate the execution that George Romero does in the Living Dead films. Because when they either want to go hide in the attic or in the basement or go out and face the zombies, you don't realize what an expert job he does at creating that tension,
yeah,
between personalities and do we do this or this to survive until you see it done horribly like Maximum Overdrive or Trucks.
Interestingly enough, Romero and Stephen King are really good friends.
Oh, they did. Creepshow.
They're like the best of friends, yeah, for 30-some years.
But you don't realize, like, I kept looking for it in Maximum Overdrive and Trucks, like this moment between, like, we need to go out and feed them and do this, or no, we need to not be slaves. He never went into that. It's like, that's the stuff Romero thrives on, that do we, you know, what do we do, and let's have clashes among our personalities about doing it. He doesn't do any of that. I guess it's easier not to do it.
Yeah.
But Romero does, and he does it great. Well, it kind of made me miss that.
He's also coked up.
Romero was not coked up.
Romero
was not coked up. We met him. He's
Black Tar Heroin,
he's very
but not coked.
Sedate.
Yeah, for a 6'5" dude with a ponytail.
He's 80. What did you?
I think when we met him, he was about 70.
He's in the 70s.
Yeah.
Couldn't,
that was 5 years
nice
ago.
Couldn't be a nice
one. Oh, yeah.
But let's go on now. All right, so nobody watched Trucks. I'm not going to get too much into Trucks. I did ask everyone to kind of give some thought into their top five King adaptions that worked for them and their ones that did not work for them. And I'd kind of like to get into that a little bit. I don't know when we're going to come across Stephen King again. I know after Maximum Overdrive, I don't want to watch anything having to do with Stephen King.
Well,
again.
If we ever do Shining in the Kubrick.
I don't love him Cocaine Drive.
But
Maximum Coke Drive?
The one thing I want you to lead into this, in some of the interviews I read, it was funny how whenever you see a movie that says Stephen King's name on it, or a script that says, you know, script by Stephen King or story by Stephen King, there's a lot of legalities and politics that go into that. And Stephen King said, you know, it's amazing how many movies will give me, this is the final draft of the screenplay, and it'll have a lot of the stuff he's done in it. And we want you to sign off for the Writers Guild, so where your name is screenplay by Stephen King. But they're pulling the wool over his eyes. It's not the final draft of this. It's not the shooting script. They just want him to sign off so they can put his name on it. Because then he'll watch the film, and it'll be none of that.
But he said he doesn't give a shit, though.
No. He learned that the hard way.
Yeah, he learned it a long time ago.
But
so it's kind of like Carpenter with remakes.
He's one of those guys. Well, Carpenter wants a check.
Yeah.
That's what he loves about remakes, is it's a check.
Yeah.
Stephen King was like, you have to factor in some things. Is an unknown writer who could get his name on something, am I taking it away from him by contesting his screenplay?
That's a good point, because he doesn't need the check.
He doesn't need the check. But he's like, how much did I contribute to this? And a lot of times, the producers will give him a script and be like, this is our shooting script. Sign off on this, because you wrote most of it. But it's not the final shooting script. And when he watches it, they just wanted him to sign it so they could say, screenplay by Stephen King.
Or Stephen King's
Sleepwalkers. So I think over time, he got really, really used to being cautious. And I think he would err on the side of, don't put my name on it, because it's not going to be what I want it to be. So I thought that was an interesting kind of dynamic, like someone actually fighting to have his name off something, whereas everyone's so hungry to have their name on something. But let's start with Tuttle. No? We're going to start with Cody?
Oh, we can start with me.
Okay. Your top five, Stephen King.
I don't know if I can get through top five.
Okay.
But I will say
just name whichever ones you like and don't like. I mean,
well, I loved Maximum Overdrive until watching it.
this isn't starting well.
I loved Running Man, which
very different from.
Yeah, it's completely different than what King wrote.
But I love the movie.
He did come up with that name.
Yeah, it's his idea. It's based on a story. Very different.
I saw Children of the Corn first, the movie, and then I read the book. Even though the book is totally more scary and just malicious than the movie was, I still appreciate the movie. I liked it.
You're not going to find bigger Children of the Corn fans than me and Kate.
Yeah. Christine, totally down with Christine. Carrie, I don't know about, because I don't know whether I liked, you know, Sissy Spacek in it versus the whole movie. Whatsoever.
You had problems with Sissy Spacek?
No, I liked the movie. Oh, okay. I thought it was pretty cool.
Have you seen any of the myriad remakes? I have not.
No, I haven't either.
I was curious to see if anyone had seen
those. Actually, there was a weird movie. First of all, it contributed to my total distaste for clowns. I can't stand
Did
clowns.
It start with Poltergeist?
Oh, Poltergeist. Fucking clown in Poltergeist.
I don't know how many people I've met from our generation have a fear of clowns because of Poltergeist.
Poltergeist and it solidified it. I don't like clowns. Poltergeist.
Correct me if I'm wrong, it was a TV miniseries, wasn't it?
Correct. Yeah. Okay. Correct, it was. With Tim Curry, who I love. Love Tim Curry. King has done a lot of
TV almost equal to what he's done in film. So
a lot of TV miniseries.
TV's open to discussion. I haven't seen a lot of it.
I like The Last Stand, the TV miniseries that The Last Stand did. The Stand, yeah. The Last Stand was Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Which was an awesome
movie. There's a whole bunch that, because I'm not a prolific Stephen King reader, I don't know how accurate they are to the books, but I enjoy the movies.
Okay.
I can respect him going, you know, this isn't my vision at all. But at the same time, I just watched Maximum Overdrive, which you said was your vision, and that's fucked up. I don't really care about it. Give me Running Man. Give me Children of the Corn. Stanley Kubrick Shining that I know that you did not like.
Running Man is a phenomenal movie for what it is. Or for, you know, it's a completely different concept. In the book, The Running Man, which he wrote under his pseudonym, Richard Bachman, it was a desolate poor man entered this game to save his ail sickling wife.
Yeah.
And the hunters weren't these superheroes that came down. It was basically him. It was almost like Survivor, like him.
He actually was running. There was no underground cavern. No, like, you're running across the state.
A state. He was running through society, hiding in hotels, and they're more like Dog the Bounty Hunter, kicking down doors and trying to.
Yeah.
It was a very different, very bleak, more bleak if you can imagine that. Just very.
If you
dirty,
haven't read it, it's a very dystopian. It's a wonderful, so you'd really like that.
I probably like it.
Wonderful
yeah.
thing. I mean, the end of it is fucking Arnold's character, Richard Bachman, driving his fucking plane with his entrails hanging out. Straight into the tower, the TV tower. Mm-hmm. Just
where Killian is at.
Yeah, where Killian's at. All right, Minty, top five.
I am a prolific.
I was about to say, you
King.
Are prolific.
So, they're very hit or miss. I definitely, I don't know at what point, but you've got to look at them as two different mediums. They are completely two different mediums.
Sure.
And I can understand where, like you were pointing out earlier, Cade, if a guy wrote a novel and it's his creation, they think of it as their baby, but you've got to understand, even if you're the writer, it's two different mediums. Cut me the check and do whatever the fuck y'all want with it. And you just got to say, you know what? It's not my book. They're adapting a movie from my book, which is totally different. So it's hit or miss. I mean, you know, I'm a big Carpenter fan. Cade can write the book on Carpenter. I'm a big fan, too. Love Christine's. Great movie. Love the novel. Just like Tuttle said, the Children of the Corn short story. Absolutely fantastic short story. Totally different from the movie, but I like the movie.
And the sequel.
What about the... sorry to interject.
Oh, no.
What about the TV remake that was on Sci-Fi that I thought was more... in line with the book.
It was more in line with the book.
It followed the story, but I didn't care for it as
I
much
didn't
as
care
for
the character. Yeah. The characters were ingratiating. I wanted to kill them both.
Okay.
The vet and the and his wife. I just wanted her to die. I
and when he starts having that knob flashback in the cornfield,
oh, that was
kind of makes you want to check
that was laughable. Yeah. So
I'm trying to think of ones that you know. I'm trying to think on the negative scale.
The Langoliers.
You know, I never saw the adaptation of it.
I actually kind
of
liked
not
the movie.
Care, and did not care for the story.
Yeah.
I really like the novel Night Shift. They've done it twice, both times in TV miniseries. Both of them are not good. I really liked the Misery book. I did not care for the movie with James Caan.
You didn't like the movie. Why not?
Something about it I didn't like. I don't know why. Okay. It seemed boring compared to the book. The book was really like a real slow burn, and really it put you in there. Like, if you're incapacitated and can't get away, what do you do?
Yeah. I thought the movie captured that pretty good.
I liked it.
I didn't like it that much.
I mean, Kathy Bates is such a strong deal. And
didn't care for the Pet Sematary movie?
Con. Nah. Other than Herman Munster.
Fred Gwynn. I kind of feel, in a way, and this is obviously not anything that's going to win me over with the people that look at drinkers and drug users in a bad way. Drugs are a totally different thing, but I always kind of feel like King's work took a dip towards the South after he gave up the substances. It was working for him as a writer. It's hard for me to say top five or worst five.
What about bottom? Any books that you loved or stories that you loved that when you watched it you were just like so disappointed that you were just like, man, I love this book, and you totally blew it.
Totally blew it's harsh, but I loved The Stand and did not really care for the TV miniseries.
Really?
And it's kind of, to be fair, and you can say this about all of King's work, it's a good conversation, but it's one of those things where to adapt it faithfully or even close to it is next to impossible.
And, because it's so cerebral.
And, you know, the same thing was said about Bret Easton Ellis and his work, and he kind of nitpicked over everything that was done over it. And
yeah.
Same thing, he finally wrote a screenplay, and they changed it around with The Informers, and I think he finally came around and realized it was two different mediums, but it's how can you faithfully adapt an 1,100-page novel? They did, I think, four 2-hour parts to The Stand, And it was on network TV. Yeah. You would have had to have done a 12-part R-rated HBO miniseries to get close to it.
That would actually be pretty good.
It would have been. I was disappointed in that. I don't think I can say I read anything where I was just like, oh, I wonder if, totally fucked
I wonder
it up.
If now with the, you know, the HBO and Showtime doing what they're doing with Game of Thrones and that kind of
thing.
With Showtime and HBO doing what they're doing with Game of Thrones and some things like that, like they've been talking about forever doing an HBO thing of The Gunslinger.
Oh yeah, that'd be nice. Dark Tower?
Dark Tower.
And that's seven books that average about 700 pages apiece. You have to do it that way.
And you have to do it on something like HBO or Showtime to capture the violence, the effects.
And that's something, you know, like...
That'd be worth it.
Going to my list, you know, it is in my top five.
Mm-hmm.
Because I read the book well before I ever saw anything on screen.
I read the book, liked it, never saw the movie.
Yeah, I saw the thing because I'm like, all right, well, you know what? I'm going to read the book first. So I read the book, and it's a slog. You got to get through it. I mean, first few hundred pages before anything even starts happening.
It's 1,000 pages long.
Yeah. And so, you know, and it just bored me to tears. But once you got past that first, you know, probably about 250 pages, it started to make sense. He laid down all this, you know, this groundwork. But after that, it became interesting.
Yeah.
Things started happening. You started wondering what's going on here. You know, you'd put it down thinking, what's going to happen next? But when I watched the series, Tim Curry, I liked it, but it was not the same. It was obviously...
Well, it's hard because it's hard to like John
You're limited, Lloyd. But also, you know, like you said it before, when you're watching that film, you're watching what that director wants you to see.
True. It's a director's medium. Anytime you write something and someone else gets behind the camera...
It's their story at that point.
Yeah, it's their... You know,
there's one like more it, I was going to throw
like
out
it,
there,
credit
though, which
me,
is...
Don't
a,
like it, blame me.
Yeah, great. But, I mean, but they were... I like them both, but for different reasons.
So it's high up in your list.
Yeah. I thought that was one... To me, that's one of the better books.
What else?
No. I like The Running Man, the film, just because the overtop Schwarzenegger, the, you know...
I think it's one of those weird things that it's totally different than the Schwarzenegger.
That's really a case where someone just took a very loose idea
and
of what
I also,
wrote about.
You know, when someone says, like, oh, this is The Running Man by Stephen King, well, this is based upon his work. So we took that premise
really
of a guy being chased
by... He didn't have Mick Fleetwood in there...
No, but I mean, it's a great example of taking something that's great and doing something totally different that turns out great on its own.
Right. In a lot of movies, I think they should, you know, even though they say it's based on the book, they need to really emphasize.
Exactly.
It's
I
an adaptation of the book.
Well, we just took a very loose idea. We took a very loose idea and made a movie out of it.
Recently,
I like that.
Here recently, World War Z is the same thing. The book
completely
is,
different than the book.
It's book nothing totally like the book. Different
Correct.
Than the movie.
You know, one of my... My top five, Stand By Me. Based off The Body.
Never read the book.
The story, The Body.
They're actually very similar.
They are. And that's why I liked it. I mean, once again, you're limited by film and a time constraint. But they're very close. I always put it, you know, Stand By Me is kind of like... To put it in perspective, you know, that everyone always does a childhood story reminiscing, and this is one where it's like, it's kind of real. I mean, you know, four kids in that time period.
There's actually a case where Rob Reiner is not coked up and is an experienced director, so he's working with a bunch of young actors and he's getting performances out of them.
Yes.
And a lot of those guys are very, very inexperienced at that point.
That was what is amazing about that film, is that those four kids... Put such. I mean, it's
Even
a movie
Kiefer Sutherland,
about
he done
kids.
Much
I mean,
at that
it's
point.
Not The Sandlot.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, these kids are out there, and even in the movie, there is that moment when you know they ask their friend, "Hey, tell us," because he's a burgeoning writer. He tells stories, and he tells a story, and it's just campy about some, you know, fat kid goes to the thing and pie eating contests, and then he pukes on everybody. And through this whole thing, I mean, you're watching the movie, and then there's this. That little kind of dream sequence of him telling his story and everything that happens, and you know, like this is
just kind of what I say about it's a realism. The kids aren't. It doesn't say that they're all afterwards. They have a yay, good, happy life. It just
yeah. Some of them doesn't it's go something. Good for some
it's
them.
A it's a
yeah.
moment in time. It's something they did. They saw, went and they for a few days. They went and saw a dead body, and then when they were done,
that was it.
And afterwards, well, it wasn't all happy go lucky smiles.
I'm gonna need to watch that movie now.
Yeah.
You've never watched Stand By Me?
It's a good movie, but it's very close to the story of the body.
No, really.
Yeah.
Did read it?
Yeah. And then, of course, one of my favorites, one of the short story movies, Cat's Eye?
Ooh, that's yeah.
That's a good one.
Which is one of the few the King was very proud of the movie.
Yes. I loved every short they did.
I believe it's in Night Shift, right? It's called Quitter's Inc.
Yes.
Quitter's Inc. is in there with James Woods.
Yeah.
But he worked very hard. There's another Dino De Laurentiis, like Max Mugrad, and he kept trying to get King to work. Like, he came up with these stories, like, well, can you make the cat appear in all of them? And King's initial instinct was, like, artistic, like, I can't. That's not what these things. He's like, but then I thought about it, like, all right, I can work the cat into all these stories to make it kind of a
cute time frame. Like, also had him on the coke.
But then he was also... Well,
it was Quitter's Inc. It was The Ledge and the little creepy.
That was where the cat took the breath away from the Drew Barrymore character. Yeah.
But then, you know, De Laurentiis was also because it was
those first two were great, though. The Ledge.
This was coming out of E.T., and he was in. Dino De Laurentiis was in love with Drew Barrymore. He said, can you work her into every story? And Stephen King was like, no. Like, it's too much. I worked the cat into everything. I can't. And he's like,
Was it Robert Hayes?
Yes, it was Robert Hayes. Ledge.
And Kenneth McMillan, yes, who was Baron Harkonnen from
yes,
Dune.
Yes, correct.
Okay, yeah.
The Ledge, those, I mean, all which, three of
by
those.
By the way, The Ledge is the short story. Night Shift?
Or I know Quitter's Inc. is in Night Shift.
It's Night Shift. I think The Ledge might be Skeleton Crew. Maybe it's Night Shift. But that short story, The Ledge, oh my God.
Now
the movie's great when that pigeon's pecking him on his ankle.
Yeah,
but the story. It's one of those cases where the written word conveyed so much more to me, this guy on this ledge, than the film.
Okay, I was going to say Larry King. Alan King is the guy from Quitter's Inc.
Larry King.
No, I knew it wasn't him.
I'm on the ledge.
I knew it wasn't.
Tonight, let's go to Jimmy in San Diego.
I knew it wasn't Larry King. I couldn't think of his name. Alan King.
Well, now I can just picture Larry King on that ledge.
So how long was it to you?
No,
ex-wife number six. I might as well just jump.
You've been punished,
Sledge. It's a horrible
jump. Well, my Larry King was very BC.
Cody and I are writing a song called Tuttlestruck. It's the Thunderstruck.
BC-like, wasn't it? My Larry King was very BC-like.
It was.
I'm on the Sledge. I'm on the Sledge. I'm fall down. I don't want to talk like this.
Okay. Now I would give a posthumous shout out in terms of the movie Christine. Just for the effects for the car rebuilding itself, like every time it gets like messed up or
Cade
destroyed.
And I have a photo I love that, you one know, of the last two
that kind of creepiness where you see the car like destroy itself, knowing it's going to be back like perfect the next minute.
Do you have a failure from King, or do you just choose to focus on the good stuff?
The Langoliers did not come across well.
Okay. Again,
it was a TV.
Yeah.
There was nothing about that story that
I didn't like the story, though. It was in 4 Past Midnight, right? Yeah. That was the book. I didn't like the story, so I never saw the movie.
About the Time Eaters, about these people that get trapped on the other side of time.
I did like Secret Window with Johnny Depp and John Turturro. That was a good movie.
Yeah.
I did like it. I didn't include it on my list because I've only seen it once. I'll just go into my top five, I'll just rattle them off. Christine, I thought he captured it. There was some stuff in the book with the ghost living inside the car with him, like talking to him.
Carpenter said that.
Oh,
that.
Wow.
We went
yeah,
to
if you read the book, the ghost actually is present in the car. Yeah. And talking to him. Like, it was a conscious choice not to do that.
Well, we were at the thing at the Frightmare where Carpenter was up there talking about it. Cade and I went to a panel where he was talking about it. He said he chose not to do that.
Cause he wasn't going to have anything to do with that. And it was the right call. I thought the movie conveyed Artie, that transformation, I thought from Artie to harmless nerd to psychopath, is what King wanted to see.
Great performance by Keith Gordon. And
great performance by Keith Gordon. But I thought that's what King wanted to see in Jack Torrance in The Shining, the transition from a normal man to a crazy man. His thing was Jack Nicholson always looks crazy.
Yeah. He says as much, doesn't
he? Says as much. He's like, Jack Nicholson looks crazy when he's normal.
Yeah.
So how can you have him transform into the psycho? He's Jack Nicholson.
You wanted like John Voight or Michael Moriarty?
I thought Artie portrayed in Christine the transition from a helpless nerd to a disturbed psycho just beautifully. Yeah. And I thought, you know, what's his buddy's name?
Oh, when the podcast is done, Cade and I'll tell how we bum-rushed John Stockwell at the bar at the fair.
We cock-blocked John Stockwell at the bar, but we'll talk about that. But John Stockwell was phenomenal in
totally
the bar.
CB'd him.
John Stockwell was great. What was the girl from
Baywatch? I actually have the photo of that. Yeah, that's beautiful.
The girl from Baywatch?
Alexander Paul.
Yeah, there is a photo of us at Frightmare with Nancy.
I just shove. He's macking on this chick, and I just shove Stockwell out of the way.
Oh, you gotta post that.
We will. We'll put it on the website. Christine number one, Shining. Hey, King be damned.
It's a beautiful movie.
It's a masterwork. King called it a gorgeous, beautiful car with no engine. I think it's just a different kind of engine.
Yeah.
And if it didn't, it's just an auteur movie. You're watching it because of the guy doing what he does, and. You know, say what you want. It is what it is. Number three, I have Creepshow.
Oh.
I thought that was the best blend of Stephen King's humor and his campy, kind of easy comics upbringing. Leslie Nielsen with the Ted Danson thing on the beach.
That was a great one.
Whether it's Stephen King with the meteor shit.
Where's my cake, you bitch?
The old guy with the cake who wanted his cake, the zombie. The old guy with the cockroaches. Like, that's just George Romero doing gore great. That's Stephen King writing good humor. It encapsulated everything I love about both those guys. Number four, I've got Carrie. I thought, you put that film in any other filmmaker's hands, it could have gone a million different ways. That film, Brian De Palma, it was so stylized. Same with Scarface. He did Scarface.
One of us is going to
jump
on those.
That movie in anybody else's hands could have been such a joke. Tony Montana and Scarface could have been a total fucking blooper reel of joke if it wasn't in De Palma's hands. And I thought the same thing with Carrie. He kept it real, he kept it grounded, and his editing kept it the guy edits like nobody's business. And music, like, De Palma and King should have done more.
Yeah.
That should have been. And King said as much. Like, I wish he'd do more of my stuff. I mean, he just phenomenal. And then I got number five, I got Children of the Corn. I know King isn't happy with it, but
it's a great movie. It's one of our favorites.
And Children of the Corn Part 2 is kind of like our Halloween 4. It's that
great sequel.
You're not going to win any cinephiles fandom like saying you're.
It's a horror fans movie.
Fuck them. It's a fun movie.
Yeah,
and I love it. The one Cujo was a runner up.
I had a hard time with Cujo because I just. The premise to me never.
You've had a child.
Yeah.
No,
knew that one was coming.
Cody, until you've had a child.
You just don't know.
No, Tuttle. Until you've had a child.
Keep talking about fatherhood.
Minty, I'm sorry. Until you've had a child.
Can you just read your list?
Until you've had a child. You cannot imagine what it's like to get stuck in a car.
Can she have a sandwich on whole grain bread? I'm just saying, why can't she have her sandwich on whole grain bread? It's white bread, Lois. Can you have a sandwich and whole grain bread?
I'm just saying, until you've had a child. I'm sorry. Until you've had a child. But no, it's not even until you have a child. I haven't watched that movie since I've had a child.
But, and all I was saying was just the premise. Maybe the writing is different, but the movie itself never gave me anything.
Every time I see it, I appreciate the filmmaking involved, the training of that dog, the acting of that fucking kid. I think it's Joey Lawrence's little brother.
No, it's the dude from Who's the Boss.
Yeah, Matthew Lawrence.
I think. Danny Pintaro from Who's the Boss.
Yeah, it is.
Tony Danza and Alyssa Pintaro.
I know who's the boss.
That's who it is.
Oh, do you?
Yo, Angela.
You've been turtle struck.
Hey, yo, Angela.
Dude, that's who it is.
No, Joey Lawrence.
Dude, I'll go on a limb, man.
No, that's fine. Anyway,
I've been wrong before.
The kid was good. and the dog was good, but that I didn't put it in my top five, asshole. I put it in my top, my runners up.
There's no need to get aggressive.
Sorry,
easy.
I also had misery. I also had misery in my.
No one else had runners up.
You know, interesting story about misery. Do you know that they're doing that on Broadway at the end of the year with Bruce Willis as the author?
I'm mortified.
So am I, because I know you didn't make that up. No, I know you didn't make that up. I know you're telling the truth. I am mortified also.
Hey, I'm going to rewrite the scene.
They're doing Misery on Broadway with Bruce Willis as...
Cody, hold me.
What's the author's name? Paul something?
For some reason, I just...
Paul Sheldon?
Paul Sheldon. Paul Sheldon.
Why do I just get this horrible vision of, like, Willis being on stage in a bed, like, start doing his little voice?
Hey,
just sitting here.
Is it a musical? I'm in this bed. My legs are broke. I can't run away.
No, it's not a musical.
It's okay. No joke.
It's no joke. I could use a smoke.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
No.
Annie, will you let me go?
No, it's not a musical, and you know what? We always hope for the best from Bruce. We don't get it a lot, but we hope for the best. But those are my runners-up. My two asterisks, as you can't really count them as King stuff, was Running Man, because it's so different, and Sleepwalkers. That was an original script that King did for the screen, which I love that movie. It's about an incestuous mother, son, family lives out in the woods, and they're cat people. They turn into cats. Fucking really entertaining movie.
Yeah.
I really dug that movie growing up.
Yeah.
I'm not getting any...
Yeah, I saw Sleepwalkers.
The whole Willis and Misery thing just reminded me of.
I saw Sleepwalkers and I got
of the
none
Apes,
of that.
The musical.
All right, well,
Dr. Zaius.
Real quick, I'll go through my disappointments.
It's a part I was born to play.
Number one, The Lawnmower Man.
Oh, that sucks. Yes.
Boy, that had nothing to do with The Lawnmower
Yeah.
Man. Talk about buying a title.
Come on, we all like Fahey.
No, the original was Pierce Brosnan.
I thought Jeff Fahey was.
I think he was in Lawnmower Man 2.
Oh,
was he? Oh God, that
I
shows
think Pierce
how.
Pierce Brosnan.
There was two of them.
What?
No,
but the original was like a computer thing. Like
yes,
people got. No, the original Lawnmower Man was a short story where a guy hired a guy to mow his grass. The lawnmower ran itself. He walked behind it naked, dripping in.
So he just
green
wanted
grass
the title.
Yeah, they bought the title.
We need.
Yeah,
they bought the Stephen title. King wrote a thing called
Lawnmower.
It was
the most terrifying thing I ever read when
Here's $400,000. What? Okay.
It was the most terrifying thing I read as a kid. And the movie was. Like,
I cut some people I gotta pay off.
The movie had nothing whatsoever to do with the title. The second one is Creepshow 2, The Raft. Which was a short story in Skeleton Crew where a bunch of college kids go out to this lake, swim out to a raft.
I actually like that one, yeah.
It's a great short story. Did you ever see the film?
Yeah, I did.
You like
with the goo that like
yeah.
came up?
See, I didn't have a problem with that. I had a problem with the two that bookended it.
Yeah.
I didn't mind the raft. I mean, obviously, it was...
I liked the raft.
It was 1987. They threw some kind of... They poured glitter on some piece of... screen and threw it in the water.
I forgot that that was Creepshow. I was actually thinking that Creepshow. Was like a Tales of the Crypt thing.
Well, you guys liked it. It was a monumental short story for me. I didn't think it lived up to the mainly poor acting. Bad acting.
Well, I haven't seen it since the 80s.
And my number three thing, disappointment, was The Mist. The reason being...
Oh, interesting.
Good acting. I like Thomas Jane. I like a lot of the people involved. The CGI monsters... ruined it for me. When they're in the back of the grocery store and those tentacles come under the door.
They were pretty cheesy.
Clearly CGI. That's one of those occasions where I'm like, you know what? It would cost you nothing to make a rubber tentacle and put it under that door and I would believe it. It was so CGI, you took me out of it. Movies that lose me at CGI... I don't give them any.
It's interesting because
that was kind of what I had problem with, like the Langoliers when I watched that one, and I was like, because I was expecting, you know, it's an interesting premise,
yeah,
but it was that '90s computer animation,
like
they come out all
on
like
the forefront of it that they haven't really perfected the craft, yeah,
it's like they're made of chrome,
yeah, exactly, yeah, well, they haven't perfected the craft,
They did some practical stuff, the flying stuff inside the supermarket. They did some flying puppets and stuff, which is cool. But those simple things that they could have done rubber and they went CGI, I can't.
That's interesting. That didn't take me out.
I immediately check out.
And The Mist is one of his greatest stories.
It's my favorite. It's the one I've read the most. And it lost me at that. Which is unfortunate because it has that downbeat ending where the dad kills the son.
Yeah.
It had a lot of stuff that was begging to. I would be on board.
Didn't King say he wished he'd end the story that way?
Yeah. There's only a few adaptions. He said they did it better than he did.
I haven't seen it. Haven't read it. Now I want to.
Well, read it and don't watch it because you'll see computers.
If you have not, if you have not bought his book of short stories, Skeleton Crew, it came out after Night Shift, about 85. If you haven't, buy that and read the stories.
Buy Skeleton and Night Shift.
I was supposed to say I've read Night Shift.
Between Battleground, with the toy soldiers coming alive, Gray Matter, where the guy drinks the tainted beer and turns into a fucking.
How could that ever happen?
Skip ahead 3 hours.
Look over here. All of a sudden, I'm Jabba the Hutt. Yeah. Hey guys.
Yeah. I think tonight's a testament just how much influence this guy's had over film. And
I love the dude. I'm a kingophile.
Everybody loves him. Really, I know you are, and that's another reason why. Besides, Tut wanted to do Maximum Overdrive. I wanted you to be here because I know you know a lot about the guy, a lot about what he's done. We've all. You know, I've read so much of his stuff. That's something to be said. I've read more King's things than any other writer because I started reading him in middle school, and he's one of the first guys I discovered. I've just read so much of his stuff. But I think we gave Maximum Overdrive a fair shake. I think it's fun. If you don't take it too seriously, it's a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
And if you take it too seriously, you're
in trouble.
You're in trouble.
It's a good bad
movie. Absolutely.
Emilio's AF1 cigar. Everyone seemed
huge fan of that.
I'll buy it.
Yeah,
I'll buy that.
Tuttle will buy it.
I will buy it. I will smoke.
Cody will buy it and smoke.
Same with me. I'm gonna look for another one.
And I don't say that often about cigars this dark.
There you go.
In fact, at all.
No.
But in the 1554?
In the 1554, you know what?
Going through.
Last-minute substitution.
Treated me right.
Came out great.
I dig it. That was him saying no.
I was giving her the signal we're done.
Oh, okay. I thought you were like, don't listen to Mince anymore.
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, we've totally edited you out.
That's a totally different...
I will want something shortly, but I'm going to come down there and see you personally.
She should be worried.
She should now be you're very dead.
Worried. The 1554 stepped in like a champ tonight. Chocolate. A lot of chocolate. Not flat at all.
No.
That was the big thing I had with the porter. It was a very flat beer. This was lively and flavorful. It went great with Emilio.
Yes.
And, I mean, God knows we drank enough of them. I think we're happy.
Yeah.
And, what more could you ask for?
Not a lot.
Bad movie, good cigar, good beer. It's a balancing act.
Yeah, and sometimes it's
wonderful times.
Once again, you get 2 out of 3, you come out on top. Mincy, quit crying.
Sorry, I just get so choked up.
I know. It's okay, buddy. It's okay.
Let's get drunk.
Let's end this podcast.
What have we been doing?
No. This is work.
Oh.
All right, this is...
Let me end this podcast so we can get drunk properly.
Am I getting paid?
And, which we're pretty good at doing. Thank you for joining us for episode 5. Emilio AF1, a winner. 1554 by New Belgium Brewery. A fantastic beer. We all dug it.
Yep.
Maximum Overdrive. Give it a shot if you're looking for... Hey, you know what? If you're drunk at 3 in the morning, it's on late night TV. Otherwise,
that's probably the best review King ever thought he'd ever get.
Yeah. So, but no, you know what? A good night. I don't think we left any stone unturned.
I don't think so either.
All we do. So let's end this. May the wings of liberty never lose a feather.
For
For more on O'Brien's Irish Pub, the live music leader in Central Texas, please visit O'BriensTemple.com and download their free smartphone app, where you'll find full beer listings including over 40 on tap, menu information, and a calendar of upcoming events. And to learn more about the Maximum Overdrive in my pants, you can... What's that, Matt? Oh. And to learn more about the cigars and libations enjoyed on tonight's episode, you can visit www.houseofemilio.com and www.newbelgium.com. To listen and purchase music heard on tonight's program, check out www.fritzbeermusic.com. Thank you for listening to the Tuesday Night Cigar Club podcast. This is Keith A. Howell saying until next time, friends, unless we see you sooner at the pub. So keep it smoky, and for God's sake, keep it ballsy as well.